In my time on YouTube, I've covered all kinds of horror series on the internet. The Mandela Catalog, Local 58, The Backrooms, Gemini Home Entertainment, The Monument Mythos, just to name a few. I believe all those series are great, and there's fantastic projects getting posted to the site every day. But because I've seen so much of it, it's hard for me to find something that I would consider new. Like, sure, there's a ton of series that do new things with ideas I'm familiar with, but it's a rare occurrence when I find something that I truly haven't seen before. One of those rare occurrences is what we're talking about today. Oakburn Opus is one of the most inventive and frightening horror projects I've come across on YouTube. Posted to the Red Diamond YouTube channel, it tackles everything from occult horror to folk horror to Lovecraftian horror, and a monster behind the veil at the back of the series that leads others to their terrifying end, with even some demonic elements and murder mystery to boot. And all of it, from the visuals to the sound design to the plot to the intrigue, is top-notch. Few YouTubers like Nexpo and Nightmine have covered the series before, but since those coverages, there's been more entries, which means now I get to talk about it. As always, with any series I cover, do not let me ruin the experience for you. Oakburn Opus is something special, and I don't want the first time you see it to be a YouTuber explaining things that you could just see for yourself first. So there's a link to the Red Diamond channel in the description. Check it out, and then come back, and we can talk about it together. Red Diamond also has a Patreon I'm going to leave in the description as well, because artists that are doing something cool deserve to be supported. So if all of that sounds interesting to you, then stick around after the ad as we talk about the nightmare of Old Oakburn and ask ourselves what really happened at the lake in 1997. But something else that can be a nightmare is eating healthy. Between the high prices and elaborate ingredients, most people just decide to skip it altogether. Well, thankfully, today's sponsor, Factor, is here to help. Factor delivers fresh, never frozen, chef-crafted, and dietitian-approved meals right to your door. And these meals are ready to heat and eat in as little as 2 minutes. And on top of convenience, Factor is designed to support your wellness journey, and it helps eliminate stress around cooking, planning, or cleanup so you can stay focused on your goals. Every week, Factor has over 100 options, from their meals, to their salads, to their breakfast, to their shakes. And all of these are crafted for taste and nutrition. All their meals are made without things like refined seed oils or refined sugars. And most of their meals deliver over 30 grams of complete protein. And they can support your diet no matter the diet you have, whether it be gluten-free or keto-friendly. And you can get whatever protein options are best for you, everything from tofu to salmon. And you may hear that and think there's no way salmon would taste good coming out of a microwave. And a couple years ago, I would have believed you until I tried Factor. I don't know what they're doing to their food, but it works. My wife and I used to get to our favorite meals first, but recently, they're all good. Even stuff I don't think would be that great tastes delicious. And again, it's not only a meal that's inexpensive and good for me, but one that only takes a couple of minutes to prepare and clean up. Factor has made my lifestyle a lot healthier and a lot easier, and hopefully it'll do the same for you, because right now is a perfect time to get on board. That's because if you head to factor75.com or click the link in the description and use code WENDIGOONFB50, you'll get 50% off your first Factor box, plus free breakfast for a year. That's right, free breakfast for a year and your first box half off. Again, that's code WENDIGOONFB50 at factor75.com to get in on this incredible offer today. Thank you all for watching the ad. Thank you to Factor for sponsoring the channel. Their link will be in the description. And we are now back to the video. We are going to go ahead and get into it, but as always, thank you for watching. Now, while the VHS tales aren't a part of the Oakburn Opus main storyline, they do tie in. Or at least the first two do. So we're going to start this analysis by looking at the first video on Red Diamond's channel, The Circles. At the beginning of this video, we see a circle rotating that seems to be made out of fleshy growths. We're not sure what this means yet, but we will soon. After that, we see a small town in Alaska. Tex then tells us that this is the town of Etosavik on December 5th, 1986. To which we then get narration from someone named Ethan Astor. Ethan says that he is from Etosavik and that his town is being haunted. Not by ghosts or monsters, but by shapes. Specifically, the circles. Ethan says that every once in a while the circles appear. And when they do, the town is evacuated. Those that refuse the evacuation are never seen again. Ethan then says that the circles will be there in 5 days. And this time, he's staying. We then cut to the Astor house on December 10th, or in other words, the day that the circles were said to arrive. Cutting into the house, we then see a note that someone named Martha left for Ethan. We'll later learn that this woman's name is Martha Astor, and she is assumedly Ethan's wife. In the note, Martha says she's now uncomfortable around Ethan. He hasn't left the basement for days, and she's getting out of there before the circles come. We then see several perspectives from inside of the Astor home. Most seems normal. Make Your Own Kind of Music by Cass Elliot is playing on a radio, until we see an image of the bedroom, and on the wall we can see drawings of several circles. This is shown more so when we see the basement door and the basement walls that are also covered in circles. The shadow of who we can assume to be Ethan standing in front of them. That night, Channel 5 News has an alert for an anomalous event, giving us a countdown as to when this event will begin. Something I like about this is Oakburn Opus and Red Diamond's channel as a whole seem so far removed from traditional YouTube horror or analog horror. But seeing the Channel 5 News and then the report of an anomalous event almost feels like it's paying homage to things like Local 58 or Gemini Home Entertainment. On any other channel, the thing we would be watching is that news broadcast. But because this is a part of Red Diamond's body of work, it is just a piece rather than the whole. It's especially kind of charming seeing it now. I mean, there was a time period when that kind of horror dominated YouTube. All you had to do was have a small town broadcast format and say something creepy was happening and you had a hit on your hands. But now we've seen so much of that, it's like audiences' appetites have been evolving. Even the bodies of work that started out in that format, things like the Mandela Catalog or Local 58, have moved away from it into new kinds of scares. So it's weird, starting a new horror series as good as this one and then seeing that on the TV almost feels like a callback. Anyway, the TV has its countdown, and when it ends, we see a white circle on a red background. This could be an automated program for the locals to let them know that the circle event is in effect, or it could just be the circle takes over everything when it arrives, including the airwaves. Outside, we see that a massive circle has formed above the town. At the same time this is happening, someone is knocking frantically at the front door. After this, we see a circle in the sky again, followed by another circle, this one being more similar to the fleshy growth we saw in the intro, only this time there's a red light flashing at its center. Perhaps this is the circle's true form, or it accomplishing whatever it came here to do. After this, we see more images from the inside of the Astor home. This time, the TV program is flashing several circles, the center of which looks like the one we just saw, and the clock on the back wall is quickly spinning. More and more circles begin to form around the home. Lights flash, growths appear on the television and kitchen cabinets. Whatever the circle's influence is, it has fully saturated the house. The growth works its way deeper and deeper, eventually making it to the basement door, and assumedly, to Ethan. After this, we see a drawing of who we can assume to be Ethan, his eyes now mimicking the fleshy circle seen at the beginning of the video. After this, we see a spinning circle and text that reads, "A cycle of destruction and rebirth. Curved line of events with no beginning. Circling light and shadow. Through time and space. A line which can never be broken. A line which has never been born. Yet it still exists." This text is interspersed with images of, again, a fleshy circle, this time showing what appears to be a human eye in its midst. After this, we see a dark screen. The only audio we can hear is that of disgusting growths and squelching, as our image fades in to show us what we've been promised from the beginning, a circle made of flesh. Only this circle begins to speak to us, and we realize it's Ethan. He says, "I'm happy now." And we see the flashing red circle above a Tosavik once again. Ethan again says, "The people who decide to stay are never seen again. Some say they join the circles. Now, I'm one of them." And with that, the circles ends. So it seems that the reason the circle is so alluring and manages to trap people within it is because they represent a knowledge so far beyond our own. We don't know if the circle is alien or ethereal or spiritual, but what we do know is that it seems to be eternal. And to be one with the circle is to be one with infinity, a line that does not have a beginning or end. Maybe people come to that conclusion naturally after they see what the circle's capable of. I mean, for who knows how long people have been evacuating this town only for those who stick around to completely disappear. Maybe people just get curious as to what the circles are capable of. Or maybe the circle influences a few people at a time in order to join its form. The circles reminds me a lot of Uzumaki, the Junji Ito story. I made a video about Uzumaki on my channel. You can check that out. Link in the description. You know, if you want to give me even more money.
What?
But in short, Uzumaki is about a different town that is obsessed with a different shape. That shape being a spiral. The shape begins to show up everywhere, either from people's obsessions or from things in nature that take on a spiral form. In the first chapter of Uzumaki, one of the characters becomes obsessed with the shape and begins to hoard anything that has a spiral pattern on it. Ultimately, at the end of the story, contorting his own body into a giant spiral. It's revealed at the end of Uzumaki that all of the spiral obsession has been because of some entity that lies underneath the town. Something that has been doing this cycle of death and rebirth for millennia. And regardless if people worship it willingly or resist its influence, they all wind up at the spiral's altar in the end. Similarly, I think that's what we see out of the circles. There is an entity that is so far beyond our knowing that some people feel compelled to bow down to it. I mean, if we truly encountered an entity that powerful, of course there would be people who would pledge their allegiance. It would be the equivalent of God making himself known in the world. You'd have to be a fool to turn away, regardless of how awful that God might be. And it seems Ethan received what the circle promised, immortality, an escape from death. And regardless of how horrifying he seems in the end, as Ethan said, he's happy now. This is just one of the paranormal encounters that we're going to come across in the Itosavik region within this story. The next of which comes in our next video, another VHS tale, this one called The Starving Five. In the beginning, we see an old film reel of what appears to be drawings of some creature. A creature of monstrous proportions with a towering body and a stacked skull for a head. If you have your captions on, text appears that reads, "An exiled spirit, rejected from the domains of the afterlife. The earth repudiates its flesh, preventing it from rotting, damned with an endless hunger, a mouth that can't eat and a throat that can't swallow. It takes shame on its grotesque form, using every aspect of its unnatural physicality to lure and capture prey. Its objective? To bring upon the decay of men's flesh and ego." And after we see the final image of this beast of three heads, get our title card for The Starving Five. If it isn't clear enough, this story centers around a Wendigo, or at least Red Diamond's adaptation of the Wendigo. Which, I mean, look at that up there, and then like look at the channel name like down there. Pretty up my alley. Typically in the Wendigo legend, the Wendigo is a spirit that possesses people who commit acts of cannibalism. The legend originates from native tribes of northern North America, areas where it was not uncommon for resources to be scarce and the cold to be damning. So, if someone amongst your party were to die, it would be tempting to use them as a resource. But the Wendigo legend forbids this, saying that you will become the vessel of an evil spirit, cursed to forever be starving and forever attempting to satisfy that hunger. Or, as Red Diamond's description read, damned with an endless hunger, a mouth that can't eat, and a throat that can't swallow. And it's a creature that hates humanity. It despises their flesh and their ego. This creature will be our main set piece throughout this tale. Tex tells us that there is a place. A place of unforgiving cold. We see shots of the Alaskan countryside. Tex also tells us that this is on December 21st. A small cabin in the midst of the cold is lit with a dim light. We then see an abandoned, snowed-over car. As more text tells us, we are starving. The engine is dead. A flimsy wooden shelter keeps us away from the snow. We see the front door of this shelter that has been marred by the scratches of something. The text continues. Heat escapes through the cracks. Our skin hardens. Two lone rifles set in the corner. Animals sing and hiss, but nothing is seen. We are starving. From here, we can put some pieces together. A group of people came out to this cabin in the woods, and then their car broke down. Now they are out here with nothing to eat, and it seems that something is trying to get in, at least as indicated by the scratch marks on the front door. We then see a view of this candlelit corner as our narrator continues. Natasha followed him blindly. Alex dreams unquietly. I watched the rumbling snow attentively. We are not starving alone. So we have the narrator, the eye from that story, Alex, who's still in the cabin sleeping with him. But Gary thought he heard his lover coming from outside, so he and Natasha ran outdoors into the unforgiving cold. But if you're keeping track at home, that's only four people. So why is this video called The Starving Five? Well, as the narrator, who we'll soon learn is named Dimitri, says, they're not starving alone. We see more shots of the dim cabin. We can assume that Dimitri and Alex are the only two still staying here. Till suddenly, in the middle of the night, Dimitri hears a loud knock. Text that reads, "Wake up." Dimitri opens his eyes, and for a brief second, we can see the visage of something outside of the cabin window. Text then appears that says, "The anxious dreamer wanders unconsciously. Will you follow him?" One of the guns against the wall is missing, and seemingly, Dimitri takes the other. Earlier, it was said that Alex was dreaming unquietly, so this anxious dreamer is probably referring to him. That, in combination with one of the rifles being missing when Dimitri gets up, leads me to believe that Alex had woken in the night, taken a rifle, and stepped outside, so now Dimitri, that was woken by the knocking, is following after him. Alex could not even be aware what he's doing. He could just be sleepwalking, as the text said, he wanders unconsciously. But regardless, Dimitri is going out there to find him. We then see a phone and are about to hear the transcript of a phone call that took place on December 17th. Or in other words, 4 days before this group of four ventured out into the cold. We'll learn that this conversation is a phone call between Alex and Dimitri. Alex seems doubtful that they'll find whoever they're looking for alive, someone who Dimitri just refers to as she, especially considering that she's been gone for a month. But Dimitri remarks that they're doing this for Gary. This makes sense because earlier we heard that Gary was lured out to the cold because he heard his lover's voice. So perhaps Gary's girlfriend or wife had disappeared out here on her own, and then when Gary went to look for her, he heard her voice out in the cold and went running. Now, mimicry isn't a part of the original Wendigo legends, but mimicry is a part of a lot of Western Native traditions around things like skinwalkers that often gets connected to the Wendigo mythos. And if you'll remember in that opening text describing the creature, it said they use every aspect of its unnatural physicality to lure and capture prey. So it's very likely that this creature was just mimicking Gary's lover's voice, something that Gary was susceptible to since he came out here to find her. Also in this phone call, Dimitri says, "This city is hostile. All it takes is one detour, a miscalculated step, and you're gone." Dimitri is likely referring to Itosevic. It seems residents of this town know that something bad happens in the dark around here. But regardless of this, Gary seems to be in denial. So he seems determined to go out into the woods to find her, and his friends decided to go with him. And as we see from the December 21st events, this sealed their fate. Now you may hear all this and think that Gary's friends are pretty dumb. I mean, this isn't like our world where someone can get lost in the woods, so it makes sense to go looking for them. This is a place where Dimitri indicates he knows that things go bump in the night. And Alex says just the same on the phone call, saying it's foolish for them to go out there. But then Dimitri says something that's interesting and I think reflects on the rest of the series. Dimitri says, "People disappear and are forgotten year after year, and everyone turns away because they fear the truth. Perhaps the mere attempt, even if redundant, to find the truth, take us away from this melancholy." It's like there's this overwhelming dread on the people of the town because so many terrible things happen. Because it happens so often, that's all the more reason to do something when you can. Even if she's definitely dead, even if the best thing you can hope to find is a body, that's remembering someone when so many people, especially as we're going to see in future entries, have been forgotten. It's an act of humanity in the midst of an inhuman reality. But in a world as wicked as that which Oakbourne Opus portrays, acts of humanity rarely go unpunished. We're about to see that with Dimitri right now. Dimitri begins walking through the snow. Text appears that says close, then closer. Then Dimitri is spoken to specifically, the voice telling him almost there, till eventually Dimitri finds what he was called out there to see. The body of Gary lying in the cold. Not far off, Natasha lies dead in the snow as well. Through the darkness, Dimitri then sees some figure above the broken trees. Perhaps this is something blocking the moon. Perhaps this is a large eye. As Dimitri looks closer, the creature reveals itself. A mass of broken animal skulls, joined together on some amalgamation of flesh. Dimitri gazes into the beast, and it seems the beast gazes back. The beast asks Dimitri, "Shall we starve together?" Dimitri's eyes grow impossibly wide in response. The screen is caked in red. As you can imagine, it seems none of them will make it out of these woods. One brief flash we see with the text, "Shall we starve together?" is of this Wendigo creature drawn similarly to Leonardo da Vinci's Vitruvian Man. That symbolism in itself is loud enough. The idea that this creature is of some different heritage. some history or based form that we've long forgotten. But another symbol here is the position of the creature's arms. As the beast has three heads in the image, it seems to also have two sets of arms, two pointed down and two pointed up. To me, this seems reminiscent of one of the most popular positions in satanic and pagan iconography, that being the symbol of as above, so below. The phrase as above, so below traces its origins back to about the 9th century, the phrase itself originating from the Emerald Tablet. However, in the millennia that would follow, as above, so below began to take on an occultist meaning. The full phrase that is most commonly used now is as above, so below, as within, so without, as the universe, so the soul. This communicates the idea that every individual is a part of the collective. In a spiritual sense, our own microcosms are a part of macrocosms, or in other words, the unseen realm of the spiritual that we inhabit. Practices have taken that phrase and inverted it based on things found in biblical scripture, for instance. When Jesus said, as on earth, so it is in heaven, some point to passages like that as evidence of a continuity between the different realms of existence. So in other words, as it applies to witchcraft, and this will be relevant later in the Oakburn Opus story, the powers of heaven, hell, life, and death, eternity, and oblivion can be harnessed by those who are willing. This is why the phrase gets tied a lot into things like paganism or Satanism, because typically the underlying belief within realms of witchcraft or satanic worship is that the forces in question want to share their power with humanity. Instead of us merely being a part of the macrocosm, they want to give us the ability to manipulate it. Because of this, you'll often see depictions of figures like Baphomet or Lucifer doing the as above, so below pose with their hands. It's effectively Prometheus bringing the gift of fire to man, a power we weren't supposed to inherit, but is being offered to us by a more powerful entity. At least if you view the gift fondly. If you don't view the gift fondly and instead think that this promise leads to damnation, then it's more so the apple that the serpent used to trick Eve in the Garden of Eden. I could be completely off on my connection between the as above, so below imagery and the Wendigo from this story, but I think the pose from the image as well as the temptation or the offering posed at the same time, shall we starve together, points to this as something more than just a monster in the woods. From Dimitri's eye, it seems that he's been transformed. Whatever promise he saw in the creature's face, he must have taken. After this, we cut to the next day, December 22nd. We see the cabin once again with a scratched door and empty hallways, but this time, something moves in front of it. We then see someone's eyes once again, but this time they're cloudy, filled with something. Now, this could be Alex or Dimitri. Personally, I think this is Dimitri because it's Dimitri's eyes that we've seen up until this point. And perhaps Alex, under the creature's influence, wandered out in the cold the night before, only to die in the wilderness. Assuming this is Dimitri, Dimitri asks, "Where are my eyes?" Down the hallway of the cabin, he seems to get a response. "You won't starve alone." To which the monster lights a candle, and we see his visage lit at the end of the hall. The monster is in the cabin with Dimitri, but he doesn't want to kill him. Instead, as he offered, he just wants to starve together. After this, time ticks by. January 1st, Dimitri on the bed, the monster in the hall. "You won't starve alone." January 5th, the same. "Let me go." The 13th, "You won't starve alone." The 29th, "You won't starve alone. Let me go." Until Dimitri shuts his eyes and the video ends. For one, I think The Starving Five is an excellent adaptation of The Wendigo. It builds off the idea of the Wendigo being a spirit drawn from cannibalism and something that is committed to eternal starvation because of its sin. But Red Diamond takes that further and says it's not just a creature that wants to kill you, it's a creature that wants you to feel what it feels. If it must starve, it doesn't want to do so alone. It seems the only reason that it killed the other people in the cabin was to have Dimitri alone, so the two of them, as it says, can starve together. It's a haunting adaptation of the creature, and given the creepy visuals and the occult influence, I love it. Now, both of the VHS tales on their own are interesting, and both of them will connect to the greater Oakburn Opus story later, but for now, there's already one connection we have between the two. See, when the missing person posters were flashing right before Dimitri gave in to the creature's influence, during the flash, we get the full names of the four characters. Dimitri Olov, Alex Lebedev, Natasha's name has been marked out, but Gary's full name is Gary Astor. This is the same name of Ethan and Martha in the last story, The Circles. So seemingly, Gary was related in some way, perhaps Ethan's brother. So with this subtle connection between the two, it seems their worlds are connected. The world of the Circles is right next door to the world of this Wendigo. But as you're going to see, these all tie in as just fractions of elements from the Oakburn Opus story. Now that we've talked about the first VHS tales, we can get into that story. So let's dive into what is currently a four-part series, a series that is, in my opinion, one of the best on YouTube, with Oakburn Opus Part 1. At the beginning of Oakburn Opus Part 1, we open on a shot of Lake Oakburn. Text appears on screen that tells us this is 1997, and the old Oakburn population vanished overnight. This probably sounds similar to Atosovic in The Circles, as an event happened and then people who were in the town disappeared. This also tells us what the title of the series means. Oakburn, or Old Oakburn, is the name of the town. And opus is the Latin word for a work or project. You've heard the word before in the term magnum opus, referring to the superb or best remembered work from an artist's collection. So Oakburn opus implies there was some grand work being done in this town. And now, in 2024, information about the case has been leaked. We'll get hints as to who might have done this leak later on. We then see the image of what appears to be a stone monument. Tech says that a new light has been shed on the case, which branches into countless theories, hypotheses, and discussions. If we look closely at the monument, there seems to be some kind of symbol on it. This is a symbol that will be very important through the rest of the series. We're then told that what we are about to see is based on findings from a manuscript that was recovered, belonging to an inhabitant of the town, and a cassette tape that recorded the moment in which everyone vanished. From here we get our title card, Oakburn Opus Part 1. Which I've gotta say, Red Diamond kills it with the aesthetics of this series. Like, the VHS tapes we looked at so far, good, don't get me wrong, but Oakburn Opus nails it. It'll become more apparent in the later parts, especially the most recent upload, that has some of the coolest moments I've seen in YouTube horror ever. We start with our first piece of evidence, Oakburn's flutist. From here, we see this haunting image. A man stands in the midst of this cold wasteland. Large horns grow from his head, and the only sound that accompanies him are the mysterious chords of a flute. At the beginning, it's said that a lot of what we're about to see comes from a manuscript from one of the residents of the town. So, assuming that's who this is from the perspective of, they began to tell us about the flutist. On a cold morning, the outsider stumbled upon our gates and quickly became a welcome guest through the sweet and captivating melody of his flute. My people brought him into our village, a secluded place west of the Atosovic Mountains. And if it wasn't apparent enough, this gives Old Oakburn a connection to Atosovic, mentioned in The Circles. We provided the flutist food, water, and shelter, and in return, the man continued to enchant our people with the tunes of the winds. After this, we see images of the manuscript itself. Children adored him, soothed by the melodic blows. Men and women respected him for the great entertainment and happiness provided by the blessed flute. To the more humble folk, the flutist was a grateful form of art. And then we see, drawn within the manuscript, the symbol once more. This is the same symbol we saw drawn on the monument a moment ago. We'll get a better look at it later, but for now it seems to be a sigil of something. We then see depictions of this flutist, a shape drawn in wisps of the wind, once again with the horns rising off of its head. People gather around to hear the music like children, the songs enchanting them with comfort, chanting them so much so that once again, that symbol begins to appear on their heads. He hid them under the veil of reality, impossible to breathe beyond existence. Keep looking, do not follow the melody. After this, we leave the photos of the manuscript and once again are presented text, this time over a sign of Old Oakburn. He adapted to our customs, ate and drank from our kitchen, hummed our chants, and honored our altars without ever voicing a single thought. The flutist used the wind as his words and melodies as his speech. The manuscript then shows us a sort of poem. Within the wind, it hid fangs. Within the wind, it breached our spirits. Within the wind, the flute buried the veil. We then see images of the manuscript, and it's labeled Evidence 1, Handwritten Records, Author Unknown, Recovered by Martha Astor, 2002. First of all, we have the flutist, a figure who never spake, but his music seemed to enchant the people who would listen. They were given a peace and comfort from his song, and that's all they needed to bring him into their fold. Several of his details, how he speaks with the wind, the drawings, and the people around him, seemed to have a dreamlike quality, as if he brought with him a trance that laid amongst the town. But what's interesting is the mention that this was recovered by Martha Astor. Martha Astor, if you'll remember, is the wife of Ethan Astor, the main character and victim from The Circles. It says that Martha recovered this in 2002, which was 16 years after the death or circle amalgamation death thing that happened to her husband. So perhaps after what happened to Ethan, Martha became interested in the paranormal and the things that went bump in the night around this region. So she becomes an investigator and in 2002 finds these records after the population of Old Oakburn disappears. We'll be seeing a lot more of Martha later, but just know for now that she's a character in this story and ties in Old Oakburn to the Circles. From here, we get evidence to the aforementioned cassette tape, which is labeled the Magnum Opus. Like I said, Oakburn Opus refers to the idea that there was a work to be performed in this town. So if this cassette tape in the disappearance is called the Magnum Opus, then perhaps this is what the flutist was always getting to. Text says that in 1997, the great flutist of Old Oakburn announces the completion of his Magnum Opus. A presentation is set to happen Friday night at Lake Oakburn. Hundreds of men, women, and children gather near the lake in anticipation. And then the cassette tape lets us hear what that sounded like. As the crowd is speaking, the flutist begins to play, and as he concludes, the people cheer. We're then shown that monument once more, only this time, the symbol begins to glow. A red haze appears around it and begins to pulsate. Text tells us to identify, interpret, and follow. Red triangles, right side up and upside down, begin to appear in the haze around this glowing stone, and the text continues with the music, meaning the entire phrase is to identify, interpret, and follow the music. And then we see this. From this, we see this symbol made up into its full parts. At first, the parts are broken down. We see the triangles facing each other, we see the circles, and then finally the completed image of 9 upside-down triangles within a circle. This, to me, seems to be a sort of sigil. A sigil, in its literal definition, is a seal or a symbol that is meant to denote something. A king can have a sigil, an estate or a family can have a sigil. It's effectively a crest that can be placed on something to identify it as theirs. Well, in the realm of the occult, sigils can often represent different concepts or entities. There can be sigils or seals that are made to ensure protection or fortune. But in many cases, and as in the case we'll see in this series, a sigil can be an identifier for an entity. It's effectively like their name or their crest inscribed on something. In ritual, sometimes an entity sigil will be drawn to summon that entity. Like if you were wanting to perform a rite to bring about a demon or a spirit, you would draw their sigil in the midst of your worship. Or sometimes the entity will place its own sigil on something to identify its handiwork. And if it's not apparent enough already, the sigil we see here is that of the flutist. And that makes sense. The flutist did something to make everyone in Oakburn disappear. So it tracks that a monument by the lake would have his sign on it. There is a significance to the symbol itself, to the 9 triangles, to their inversion, and to the circle, but we'll talk about that later. All we need to know now is that this symbol represents him. After that, we're presented with 2 images of the wilderness. One image will display the sigil, while the other does not. This continues for a while and seems to be related to the phrase we saw earlier, identify, interpret, and follow. Since we know the sigil to denote the flutist, it seems that what we're seeing here is following the path to Lake Oakburn. Perhaps this is what it was like for all the people that came to the lake. They weren't explicitly told to be there. I mean, the flutist couldn't speak, right? But instead, they felt his presence. They were led in the direction he wanted them to go. The last split decision we see is interesting. On one side, we see Lake Oakburn, and on the other, we see this tall, horned figure, the head of which, once again, appears to be a stag skull. Ultimately, the sigil chooses Lake Oakburn on the right. I think that what we see on the left is the Wendigo from the Starving Five. We already know that Atosavik, the town from the Circles, is near Old Oakburn. And if you'll remember, in the Starving Five, it said this cabin they were in was outside of town. I think this is, again, another clue to us that the two stories take place in the same world. You drift into the woods on a dark night, and you can go to Lake Oakburn, where the Flutus Magnum Opus is taking place, or you can continue through the woods and come across the monster. Again, the monster just being one of many things that can go wrong here. This time, when we get to Lake Oakburn, both images have the sigil, this time glowing red. As we look off into the fog, we see the flutist, his hands rising through the void, as his flute continues to play louder and louder. And as we get closer, our camera begins to distort, but in the brief glimpse we get of him, this is not a peaceful keeper of the town, but instead, some sort of monster. Once everyone had gathered at the lake and heard his song, their fate was sealed. And we hear that in the cassette tape that follows. Their screams were silenced in a moment, and it says, the morning after, Old Oakburn woke up to silence. 1,043 inhabitants disappeared overnight. After quick and inconclusive investigations, little evidence was found. The existence and whereabouts of the flutist remained an unanswered enigma. That was until 2003. Search for Old Oakburn's population continues. And with that, Oakburn Opus Part 1 ends. Part 1 does a great job at setting up the story. A mysterious flutist showed up on the edge of town and enchanted everyone. This all seemed to be a ploy that eventually led them to the lake, and then they vanished. The rest of the series will be investigative moments around this event. There will be more analysis of what happened right before, what happened right after, and what happened in the years after when Martha Astor investigated the town. And as we'll soon find out, the flutist just a small part of something much older, much more sinister, that's been happening in the mountains of Alaska. So with that, let's move into Oakburn Part 2. If you'll remember, at the end of Oakburn Part 1, it said nothing was really known about this disappearance until 2003. Well, we see what that was referring to, as in the beginning of Part 2, we're told that this is set in 2003, 25 miles from Lake Oakburn at the Lebedev residence. Lebedev is once again a reference to the Starving Five, as in the missing persons poster, we saw that Alex's full name was Alex Lebedev. So somehow, Alex was related to this residence. It's also just really effective how Red Diamond can use so many different means to get across the terror in his story. Like, yeah, the flutist looks scary and a lot of the sigil images can be creepy. But in the beginning of this one, we just see a house and hear two gunshots that come from within. There's so many unanswered questions in this series, and we see this moment and our mind races as to what could be going on. Why is this residence suddenly important to us? Is this the event in 2003 that shed more light on the disappearance? Red Diamond does a great job of giving you questions every time you're out on your front foot. You think you understand how the flutist works, you think you understand the sigil's connected to him and he made these people disappear, but now there's new elements that we know are relevant, but we don't know how yet. And it's that intrigue and mystery that keeps the series so creepy, because you never know what it's going to show next. After we hear the gunshots, text appears on screen, this time in red, that says, I stood upon their blood. I stood upon the weapon, I stood before the flute, and the drowned city rose beneath my feet. Now we can assume things there like the blood and the weapon refer to whoever was just killed and the gunshots we heard, and the flute can tie into the flutist, but the mention of the drowned city is something new to us. We know something happened at Lake Oakburn, so it probably connects to that, but beyond that, we have no answers. What I really like about this line is it becomes so impactful after you finish the series, but for now, it means nothing. And it goes to show how much of this series was planned from the start. There were pieces of it planned over a year ago that were only elaborated on a few months ago. I just like to see when creators plan a series out and then satisfyingly follow through on it. We then see photographs of a crime scene. The jacket the investigator is wearing says IPD, or Atosavik Police Department. In part one, when we were seeing the sigil appear on either image that was leading us closer to the lake, one of the images had a cop car that had IPD on it. So this tells us that the Atosovic Police Department is the department that's over Old Oakburn. The timestamp at the bottom of the picture says that this took place on December 10th of 2003. As the photographs move to the interior, Tex says the melody crawls in. The voice under the veil commands, and the vessel answers. Again, things that don't mean anything to us yet, but will later. The melody, the voice, and the vessel. We then see another cassette tape, this one labeled The Lebedev Murders. We hear who is assumedly the killer laughing as red text once again appears on screen. To make it easier to understand, I'll tell you now that anytime we see red text, it is from the perspective of the flutist or something on the flutist's side or under his control. And the text we're about to see is from the Lebedev murderer. What stands before you, Detective Astor, is not a person. I exist incarcerated in a vessel of the arcane. I will entertain your feeble sense of justice. I will share you my tale. And text appears that says, he knows well his wicked ways. This phrase, he knows well his wicked ways, is also the description for the video. It comes from the song The Boy with the Gun by David Sylvian, a song that we'll play at the end of this video. The Boy with the Gun is a song about a man who feels he's been scorned by life and begins to hate life around him. Someone so bitter with the world, he wants to take the rest of the world with him. As we'll see later, this line, when applied to the flutist, is fitting. And then we get the opening title card, which, look how cool this is. A lot of the aesthetics from this series match some of my favorite horror projects. The kind of light blue gray text that appears, like the one that just said he knows well his wicked ways, reminds me of Alan Wake. Not only because of its font and style, but because of the graininess of it all, how several parts of this series feel like they're taken from an old cop drama. And then something like the bright red letters reminds me of Longlegs, another horror story about a series of killings that ultimately ties into the occult. Red Diamond may not have used any of those as inspiration for the story, but I think it's telling that getting a little hint of those influences brings out the greater influences I see in this series and other major horror projects. There's just so much passion behind the aesthetics and so many little moments in this series, it feels far more substantial than just a YouTube video. What I'm trying to say is we need to get Red Diamond a budget and a studio, if they want that. I don't know. And this is further emphasized by the next scene. I mean, look at this. You've got a series of cop cars driving through the dark country at night as this red, grainy text appears above them. Officers that we know are going to the Lebedev residence after the murder, but there's so many questions about the murder and the music and the tone and the pacing does everything it can to build that up. Every video we've covered so far, I would say, is good, but Oakburn Opus Part 2 is the first that I would say is really great. It's also at Part 2, I was like, I've got to make a video about this. The red text reads, and also, I know I said a minute ago that red text denotes the flutist or someone related to the flutist is speaking, and that's true when it's dialogue. This opening narration, like info dump, I don't think it's the flutist. I don't think the flutist is giving us the police information on the case. I think it's just an aesthetic choice. So I'm still mostly right about what I just said, that red text is the flutist talking, just not this time. I'm still right. I'm just wrong right now. December 10th, a call is made to the Atosovic Police Department from the Lebedev household. The caller confessed to having committed murder. Jackson and Oliver Lebedev were dead, their bodies aligned in the darkroom. The Lebedev brothers, naturalist photographers of Atosovic, searched to capture the empty landscape of the mountains. The criminal was never identified. For the convenience of this investigation, the killer will be addressed by the pseudonym John Doe. And then we lead into evidence 3, the Lebedev murders. This also further establishes everything we've seen so far as being part of this ongoing investigation. Evidence 1 being the manuscript, evidence 2 being the magnum opus or the cassette tape of the disappearance, and now evidence 3, the 2003 murders. It then says that what we're about to see is a timeline based on the interrogatory of John Doe, conducted and recorded by Detective Martha Astor in 2003. This lines up with some things we've seen so far. We know Martha Astor recovered the manuscript in 2002, and that makes sense if she's now a detective. And in the dialogue we heard from the killer before the title card, it seemed he was speaking directly to Martha Astor, or Detective Astor. So after the death of her husband, Martha committed herself to the paranormal, or at least figuring out whatever's wrong in the region, and became a detective at the Etosevik Police Department. And the killer of the Lebedevs knew her. Perhaps the killer himself knew her, or perhaps the flutist just has supernatural information on who he's speaking to. I mean, he seems to be something akin to a demon or a spirit after all. Based on the conversation with Martha Astor, we're told this. December 5th, 2003, John Doe is led by the melody of a wind instrument emanating from Lake Oakburn. Of course, with everything we understand so far, this makes sense. The flutist is at Lake Oakburn, and he lures people in with his song. However, this is interesting because, again, this is in 2003, 6 years after everyone disappeared at the lake. So 6 years later, the flutist is still there, luring people in. We see a quick flash of the flutist sigil, and we're once again taken to the landscape around Lake Oakburn. We then get another title card, but this one says Segment 1, Conditioning. So why are there now different segments, and what is being conditioned? Well, we're given a hint as we get the first-person perspective of someone walking across a snowy bridge. At the end of this clip, it seems a figure begins to arise out of the fog. Going back to information John Doe gave Astor, he says, "From the very first moment the flute touched my mind, I was sure to have been struck by something otherworldly, roaming the depths of the lake." Near the lake, John Doe encounters a monolith on the surface of the smooth rock. A symbol was carved, a circle, and 9 triangles. Again, this all makes sense. The flutist is luring this John Doe killer in, and the flutist brings him to the monolith with the sigil we've seen many times at this point. So perhaps this conditioning we're witnessing, this first-person perspective we saw of someone going across the bridge, was our killer being conditioned to the flutist's control. Right after this, we see a sigil flash, but this time, it's a different one. For a brief instance, instead of 9 triangles in a circle, we see a triangle surrounded by 9 circles. It is presented upright and then quickly upside down, only for a couple frames. I mean, there's obviously a connection between the previous sigil. One was 9 triangles in a circle, this is 9 circles in a triangle. But why is it different now? What could that mean? Could this symbol be indicating another entity that's out here? John Doe continues, "I witnessed in clear and inscrutable reason the flute and the man. They taught me wisdom from the bottom of the lake, the drowned city, and the millions who rest there. He raised me in that instant as a vessel." So once again, the flutist sigil flashes on screen, interlaced with an up-close image of someone's eyes shut, until as the sigil on the monolith glows, the eye opens. John Doe continues, "Emblem etched upon the rock, the beautifully profane assortment of a circle and 9 triangles suddenly gleamed in crimson hue. The song wove a web, his desire in an instant made clear. In the flute, I discerned the will of expansion, which I was to provide." Once again, as this segment is being said, the triangle with 9 circles flashes on screen. Text tells us that after the encounter, John wandered the mountain for 5 days, out of his mind and being guided by something. And then on December 10th of 2003, John came across the Lebedev residence. And of course, from there is where the murders took place. So we see what this conditioning was. This man, John Doe, was led to the lake and then brought under the influence of the flutist. An influence that showed him things like the drowned city, the millions who were there. His mind was opened and he was made a vessel. So with the conditioning phase done, we now move into segment 2, execution. As text appears on screen that tells us this, we see the flutist standing atop a hill with, assumedly, John Doe in front of him. The rope behind John Doe makes it appear as if he's on puppet strings, being controlled by the flutist wind. It also appears in his hand that he has a pickaxe or some kind of tool. He continues through the woods and, again, as we know now, comes across the Lebedev residence. John Doe continues, "It's uncommon for many inhabitants of remote areas and hidden places to forget their front doors unlocked, a naive custom, often conditioned by the emptiness surrounding it." More words from John Doe appear, but this time they're being presented to us backwards. When we wait for the scroll to end, if we read it together, it says, "Through the window, I beheld his lichen shape. The specter whispered, in evoking horror, his unfathomable name, Marv P.S. The images that are shown to us at the same time is of someone standing in the top floor of the Lebedev home and then looking outside. Specifically, standing in what seems to be the dark room of the home where we know the Lebedev brothers were murdered. I don't know why a dark room would have a window, but whatever. So it seems that once John Doe killed the brothers, he looked outside and saw the flutist, and almost as a reward for his loyalty, the flutist tells John Doe his true name. It's a big thing within the occult, especially demonology, to know a demon or spirit's true names. That can often reveal their power and their intention. And it seems the flutist's real name is Marv P.S. This name does have some influence that we're going to talk about later. John Doe continues, a name in the melody. Then once again, the name Marv P.S. flashes on screen over and over, timed with the heartbeats that overwhelm the audio. And from the profane blade touched by Marv P.S.'s fangs, I cut their eyes open in the dark room. We see an image of Marv P.S. or the flutist sigil drawn in blood. Once again, a seal so that the author of this handiwork may be known. At 11:42, John Doe furtively strikes the Lebedev brothers. Jackson takes a pickaxe hit to the thigh, snapping the femur, and is left debilitated. Oliver drags Jackson to the dark room at gunpoint upon performing a suboptimal tourniquet. We see glimpses of this, a dimly lit hallway with the dark room open. Breathing lays into the mic as a shadowy figure stands in the doorway. Oliver Lebedev, time of death, 1207. As one of the brothers is standing in the dark room, we see a silhouette attacked by the pickaxe. And again, the blood sigil is shown. We hear the gunshots once again as text says that Jackson Lebedev died at 1216. And once more, the other seal, the triangle with the three circles, appears. This time in a bright blue. From here, hypnotic imagery appears again. Circles within squares, within octagons, spinning before us. And John Doe continues, oh, Martha, the sole reason I stand before you, narrating my tale, contributing to your futile pursuit of a comprehensible truth, is to convey you his message. He calls you to the lake, your good friend beneath the veil. Visit the drowned city. Failure to heed his warning will bring the same fate upon you and the few living folks you love. You will drown too, as the slowly growing image of the flutist is now burned into the screen. Now, this does something interesting. See, up until this point, we've assumed that Martha's just here because of what happened to Ethan, right? She's become interested in stopping whatever's out here. But now it seems the flutist has an interest in her, to the degree that after John Doe made these killings, the flutist, speaking through him, simply told her to come to the lake. What is Martha that she's so special? The image of the flutist then fades into a body lying in the snow. And another image, this time of something breathing deeply in the corner. We look close, it appears to be the flutist or some other spirit. Right before we cut, opens his arms. Something important to note here is when this creature opens his arms, he seems to have six. This is very similar, even if not the exact same creature, to the Wendigo from the Starving Five. Perhaps this is a beast similar, or perhaps it's just a flutist that can manipulate his form. After this, we hear the cassette tape with John Doe laughing once again, and the song The Boy with the Gun begins to play. We then get an overhead shot of the police returning after the investigation. Finally, Tex says, in defiance of John's alleged method of murder, the bodies of Jackson and Oliver were found in contradictory conditions. Agents at the scene first observed vascular marbling, skin discoloration, and bloating in both bodies. An autopsy analysis revealed pulmonary injury, insinuating that drowning was the cause of death. With that, part two ends. You see what I mean? Every time we start to get a grasp on something, something else is given to us. We hear the drowned city, and that's surprising at first, but then we think about it, and okay, everyone disappeared at the lake, and there's millions under it. Perhaps that means bodies. So sure, it all has something to do with the lake. But then we saw the gunshots in the beginning, and we saw the image of the pickaxe hitting the Lebedevs in their home. So then how did they drown? Sure, we can connect them going out there to something to do with the drowned city and the flutist, but how did that relate to them being murdered in the darkroom? How does Martha Astor connect to all of this? What did the flutist want? Why did he want the Lebedevs dead? And of course, at the base of all of it, what happened to the 1,034 people of Oakburn? The series has so many fascinating ideas, and it does such a great job at conveying them. If you're like I am, then by this point, you're hooked with the aesthetics, with the plot, with the storytelling elements, with the horror elements. I just love how well done the whole thing is, and hopefully you do too at this point. So without further ado, let's get into part three. At the beginning of part three, the black screen fades in to a light blue hue. The noises around us imply that we're underwater, looking up at the sun. For a moment, strange chants are heard at the same time before quickly we cut to the point of view, the back seat of a car. The car sitting on the street of a foggy, empty town. The narration shows up again. The land remains still, accursed by a tragic silence for over 5 years. Old Oakburn, a village hidden between barren mountains and white woods, in its heart, the depths of the lake. A single road connects the village to its neighbor town, Atosavik. After 5 years of neglect and decrepitude, it has become treacherous. Overgrown with weeds and twigs, the path barely visible amidst the snow. I'm here now. I am home. Today, into those dark depths I must venture, and behold my secret, the very root of my curse. These waters go much deeper. From here we get our introductory Red Diamond Presents. And we see a view of old Oakburn, abandoned and caked in red. We are now outside of the car. The camera pushes in on the fog in front of us before it cuts to our title card, Oakburn Opus 3. Again, just so much of the aesthetics of this series kill me. The Silent Hill-esque town, and then the bold letters, and the presentation, and the demonic imagery, and the monsters and everything. This is so up my alley. Look, sometimes I make videos about conspiracy theories, and sometimes I make videos about like unsolved cases and stuff. And sometimes I just find something I think is really cool, and I want to talk about it. Oakburn Opus is sick. We'll see soon that the narration we were just reading was that from Martha. At the end of part two, the flutist, speaking through John Doe, told her to return. So now she is. Again, Martha is more connected to everything that's been happening than we've been led to believe. We're about to find out why now. In a couple brief flashes after the title card ends, we see images of snakes. Snakes cloaked in a red light. Until we're told, this is in 2002, right before the Lebedev murders and around the time that Martha discovered the manuscript. Now we see text that is taken from Martha's audio journal. Suspiciously, it says that the audio journal was recovered in 2010. This again raises some more questions. If Martha was an investigator in 2002 and 2003, then why wasn't this found until 2010? But for now, we get her perspective of what's happening. For now, all the evidence collected from the 1997 phenomena is abstract, frantic, ambiguous, and reveals the arcane nature of the case. Manuscript findings, diaries, newspaper entries, and the cassette tape depicting the magnum opus, some of these samples, one notices a strange constant. I believe to have found a promising clue. A line of investigation that will lead me to the truth. After this, we see an image of the flutist. This image seems to be a picture that was taken sometime far in the past, the face of which has been burned out. Martha continues, or perhaps condemn me to the most horrible perversity. A monolith, raised in the woods that surround the lake. On its surface, etched is the oft-mentioned sigil. The sigil of Marv Pias. All of that lines up so far with what we've already established. Marv Pias, the spirit or the entity or the demon or whatever you want to call it, identifies itself by the sigil, and Martha seems to have gotten that far. Crumbly, covered in moss and stained with moisture. The stone, however, reveals a more intriguing nature when analyzed in depth. I found it possible to deduce the monolith's true purpose. A tombstone. Before the monolith, we are likely to find the entrance of the tomb. which this is an interesting clue. We've been shown the monolith since part one. Now we're told there might be something under it. Also want to point out, and again, this is just typing up how cool some of the visuals are in the series, how well the image works as the text is being displayed. Because we understand the drowned city, we understand there's something at the bottom of the lake. So the visual we get as Martha is driving to Old Oakburn is the car driving towards the bottom of the screen from a top-down perspective. But as the car is driving to the bottom of the screen, there are bubbles floating from the bottom to the top of the screen. So while we're literally seeing a car driving on a road, it gives the impression of the car traveling underwater. Or in other words, it's indicative of Martha traveling to the drowned city beneath the lake. Again, just little touches like that add so much. You get more text. This time the camera switches to a rear view of the car, where only illumination is the car's red taillights. Fittingly, red text appears now. Now, earlier, I said red text typically denotes something that has to do with the flutist, and here Martha's continuing to speak, so it seems I would be wrong again. Unless I'm secretly right again, and Martha's connected to the flutist in some way. I will be conducting a solo expedition. I here now ask the department to allow the investigation to be conducted by me and me alone. My roots are here. Our marks share the same curse. His sepulchral depths are mine to explore. For those who may inadvertently stumble upon these discoveries, stay away. Here there are destinies greater than death. And as she says this, the other sigil, the triangle with nine circles, begins to flash over her car. And also, I mean, once again, just look at this. I mean, it's so good. We're going from the drowned underwater city to on land and the flipping and the stuff. The camera traces through the woods as Martha finds the tombstone. And sure enough, she was right. There's a doorway beneath it. A snake flashes for an instant before we are shown segment one, titled Necropolis, or in other words, the City of the Dead. So if the drowned city is beneath the lake, then in this forest next to the lake, a doorway down connects to it. Or at least connects to something related to the drowned city. John Doe described the millions that are housed down there. Perhaps this is the necropolis that Martha's stepping into now. Martha steps down into this cave and her narration continues. Upon prying open the tomb's entrance, it revealed a vertical descent of absolute darkness, a pit that reached the depths of the earth. And from said pit, a horrible smell. Putrid, rotten miasma rushed to the surface. Despite the unbearable exhalations, I pressed forth and began the descent. As she does, we see that the door behind her has shut. However far she's come, there's no turning back now. Martha continues through this rotting, stinking hole. As she does, we see that the ceilings and walls and floors are covered in triangle imagery. Geometry whose importance has been made evident at this point. Whatever's down here, it's something far older than Old Oakburn. As Martha presses forward, she says, black moss covered the walls. Forever damp, the smell of fish carcasses, putrid scales, disappearing into the ossuary, a gentle walk to cursed ruins, to meet what roam the ancient grounds, our sigils burned in proximity. That last sentence is interesting. What does she mean, our sigils burned in proximity? Does she mean the towns? Does she mean the flutist? How would she know if they're burning? How does she know so much about these sigils in the first place? She continues, the pungent abyss of the mortuary dragged me to secrets long forgotten, to disrupt knowledge better left unseen, a terrible familiarity. Repressed memories of times of wrath afflicted me in short flashes. The terrible burden, this obsession, being dragged to things occult. Ethan, was this how you felt? This is the first time Martha has made any mention of Ethan, and here it's fitting. She is in the depths of whatever this nature is, whatever these creatures, whatever this world truly is. And she's compelled to go deeper in spite of the fear, in spite of the horribleness of what she's stepping into. Much like how Ethan, for some reason, had to stay for the circles. She continues forward, occasionally passing suspicious marks on the ground that seem to be blood, perhaps the remnants of someone or some ritual. Eventually she stops, and it seems someone is standing at the end of the hallway. This thing speaks to her and says, behold my necropolis. The sigil of the flutist flashes, and he is standing before her. The walls around her now baked in a glowing red, same red the sigil burns with, and surrounding them are the screams of the damned. Skulls, heat, and fire seem to emanate around them. This necropolis, this city, seems little more than hell. The physical realm, the realm of the rotting bodies that Martha was in earlier, seems to have faded away for its true nature. Damnation of souls lost to the flutist. Martha comes to a door. When she's at the door, eyes in the walls glare back at her. On the door itself seems to be a massive, still-beating heart. The only thing to be found here is suffering. Martha steps through the door and then sees windows that appear to look out into the bottom of the lake. In front of the window is a sort of tabernacle, the tabernacle itself having the inscription of a deer. And on it rests a book stamped with the sigil of Marv-PS. Martha reads it, and we're presented with evidence for the first book will appear later in the series. First image we see shows us the sigil of Marv-PS once again. This time, a sort of hidden geometry within it is made more known. Circles within the points, triangles, and angles drawn amidst them. More elaborate and detailed name than that we are normally familiar with. As we look at the first page of the book, we see this. Marv-PS begins to rise from the water as he speaks, long after the wrathful times, when the serpent's tongue no longer hissed, the drowned artist, Marv-PS, rises. As Marv-PS stands, we get our first good look at him. The horns and the goat-like ears we've come to expect thus far. However, his mouth and his low-set eyes seem to be of something different, perhaps some other animalistic amalgamation. His body seems to be covered in a coarse hair, and his feet taper off into hooves. The book continues as his sigil is seen, risen from the pungent water, carrying the darkness of those eldritch depths. Throughout this section, several Latin words will appear. I'm going to say the Latin word and then its translation. Here it says tenebrae aeternae, which means eternal darkness. The burning ember boils within the dark fire. Maligni, or evil, servant to a certain viper's sin. Dies irae, or day of wrath. A trade, a price was paid. His kin spared from the gloom of the lake, and now his flesh in torment laid. The images of snakes are shown to us once more. The text continues. Rise, a call from beyond the veil, roaming the last ring. Face the fire, peccatum tuum, or your sin, his wail. Marv-PS descended the mountain's height, forever white and glamorous, seeking the land of light. The city of snow where once two miracles were born from divine glow. The people of the city, at the florid orange sunrise, were to soon regret their pity. For the wind hid fangs and the maw of the drowned city opened under his arcane chants. To swallow the accursed soil, roar the fire from nine circles, and let the water boil. And he will drown them ad tenebris, or to darkness. Into the drowned city, the gloom of the lake, the forever-breathing necropolis. And with that, segment one ends, and we head into segment two, reunion. So, that was a lot of info that gives us a whole lot to work with. I'm going to save most of it for after we have covered the videos in the series, because this will make more sense once we have Marv-PS Book 1. But from what we've seen so far, there was a bargain made and Marv-PS arose to gather more people into this drowned city. It can be inferred up until this point that Marv-PS and the forces at play here are far older than the town. And that's made evident by some of the stuff that we hear that seems to be in far history. When the serpent's fangs were cooled, how there were two miracles born from this land. And that's also seen in some of the imagery we saw in the background while the text was being read. There were depictions of flute players, of artists, and most notably, of the Pied Piper. The medieval German legend of a flute player who arrives to town and takes all the children with him. Something that obviously has some connection to Oakburn's magnum opus. Again, we'll talk about a lot of what we just read later, but for now, we're into the reunion. I mean, segment one was the necropolis, and we saw that for the hell it was. So if we're about to get into a reunion, what's it a reunion of? What two things are coming back together that's been apart for some time? Also noticed here with segment two being called reunion and getting that gray text with the line that drops off, I mentioned earlier how similar this is to Alan Wake, but it is really similar to Alan Wake 2, down to elements of Another World or The Dark Place emanating from beneath the lake within the town, and things coming out of this place to lure people into it. That's not a diss to this series saying it just took it from Alan Wake. I just like both series. We're then taken back to Martha's perspective reading the book. She's on the last page of the series of poems we read. Once again, we can see Marv P.S., his sigil, and a serpent. A serpent that's been alluded to a few points up until now, or the viper's sin is mentioned in the poem. One we haven't seen yet, but we will in a moment. For now, Martha comes across something much more alarming, as the next page of the book says her name. And around her name is the sigil of the triangle and the nine circles. Then the book speaks to her directly. Will you behold me? Turn to me. Thou shalt hear the serpent utter through thy brother's mouth. Martha then looks up from the book and begins to turn around, which I have to say, first time I watched this, absolutely terrifying. To see all that, to know how powerful Marv P.S. is, to know that there is an entity even greater than him called the serpent, then with all the questions we have, to see the book speak to her and then say, turn around, behold me, to hear the serpent speak through your brother's mouth. Which I'm going to pause again right here to say, if you have not watched this series for yourself, do not let me ruin moments like this for you. Go to the link in the description, watch the channel, and then come back, because it is not worth losing moments like these that seem so far so few nowadays. Stories like this are really worth savoring. Martha turns and looks through the catacombs. Darkness awaits her at the end, but something else. Shapes begin to mirror themselves out of the center of her image. Shapes of scales and something ancient, till she sees a scaly hand standing in the darkness. Martha looks, and for a brief moment, we see Marv P.S. as he truly is. Not covered in hair and fur as we might have seen thus far, but instead covered in scales. His arms and torso look like that of a snake's, and his head looks like that of a fish. He's not just some satyr creature of old folklore. He's forever been a disciple of this drowned tomb. I love this reveal. Through all the imagery we've seen of the flutist thus far, he looks like a goat man. Something covered in fur, standing in darkness, typical of like satyr or minotaur imagery. But when we see his true form, he's forever been something tied to the drowned city. Something cursed with scales and features of fish. Whatever this viper is, he's been transformed into its form. Rather than a beast of power invoking satanic imagery, this seems to be more of a curse. It seems that he's trapped in this form as much as he traps others in the drowned city. And from here, Marv P.S. speaks to her. And here you are, trapped within my shadow. Fear not. Contain your shivers, for there are horrors beyond my rot. Our bane, our sigils, our blood and roots are shared. And as Marv P.S.'s sigil flashes, the sigil in Martha's eye flashes as well, and she finishes his thought. An eternal bond. Marv P.S. continues, shall us recall those times? Or have you grown to abhor your very nature? The your of the sentence quickly changing to our very nature. Martha says, like earth itself, Marv P.S. continues, those wrathful days as I held your lifeless corpse. In that lake, I communed with beings far beyond. I contested death itself. Welcome to vile force, to bathe this land in blasphemy. Damned me to those depths, Martha says, to choke for eons. Marv P.S. says, a fragmented form, rotten. I reside within. The text from the book appears once again that says, thou shalt hear the serpent utter through thy brother's mouth. As a serpent appears on screen, it seems after this, we see just that, as the serpent speaks through Marv P.S. And my dead throat shall cast upon this earth the fires of nine circles, to the land that plunged me into darkest pits, to blazing marble, to the drowned city so below. And those who skin the lungs of mine will scream into the void for eons far beyond. The name of that beast, the beast that sung, Marv P.S. Images of the series flash before us. The flutist on the lake shore, the 1,034 disappeared. And right now, you probably have a lot of questions. How is Marv P.S. or the flutist or whatever he is, Martha's brother? How does Martha know about this in the first place? What do the sigils mean? Well, it seems through the rest of the book, we get some clarification on that right now. Martha Ludolph, born 1852. Matthias Ludolph, born 1852, died 1897. Oakburn, established 1897. Its motto being Dies Irae, or Day of Wrath. Its logo being that of a serpent. Martha Astor's Atosovic Police Department badge, and a depiction of the Pied Piper, overlaid, of course, with the flutist sigil. Martha Astor's findings were recovered in mid-2010 and remain classified until 2024. The material shows a direct connection between the detective and old Oakburn's flutist, while also creating doubt on Astor's true identity. And with that, part three ends. So all of that is a lot. Let's start with the most important revelation we got at the end. Martha and her brother Madhouse were twins born in 1852. Madhouse died in 1897, but Martha didn't. Martha has been alive for over 150 years. She is just as much a part of what is happening as Marpius, as the flutist, as the serpent, as anyone else. We know that the sigil of the nine triangles and the circle is the flutist, or as we know now, Madhouse, and the sigil of the triangle with the nine circles around it is Martha's. Martha has her own sigil. That's what she meant by the closer she got, their sigils began to burn together. She knew that she was returning to her brother, but how is her brother the flutist? Well, a lot of this will be explained once we see the Book of Marpius part one, but what we know for now is that according to her brother, when they were speaking there at the end, he at one point held Martha's lifeless body. It seems that she drowned in the lake. So he made a deal with these supernatural, unspeakable powers that be to bring her back, to contend with death, as he said. And it seems that whatever deal he made worked, as he was able to trade his life for hers, and death has never found her again. She seems to have been made immortal, or at least ageless, from the time this drowning took place, when she would have been 45 years old. When Madhouse made this bargain, he was transformed into the flutist, a monster made to bring more down to this necropolis, down to this drowned city. His form grotesque and rotting, as we saw and he described. And it seems that the town of Oakburn itself was established in this moment, always intended to be a playground for these powers that be, established on the Dies Irae, or the Day of Wrath. It seems that this power that made Madhouse, or this entity he bargained with, is the serpent, or the viper. There was a time in days past, as described, when the viper was violent, but that age has since left. And now the flutist is made to go out into the world and entice more to come to the lake. I don't know how much control Martha's brother has in this, and frankly, I don't know if he is now Marpius, or Marpius is just the entity that lives in him. Madhouse could just be a vessel for this creature. Marpius could also be the name of the serpent, this greater thing that made Madhouse into what he is. It wouldn't break the continuity. When John Doe killed the Lebedev brothers, he said that the entity gave its true name of Marpius. Flutist himself may be a victim, Madhouse made to act on these things after he traded his life for his sister's. Or perhaps he's become corrupted as well, content to take on his role as the persecutor. As he says to Martha, almost accusingly, "Have you grown to hate our very nature?" Perhaps he's right where they want to be. I mean, when she drowned, he knew in some way to speak to these entities to bring her back. Perhaps he knew exactly what he was getting into all along. We also get that mention again at the end that Martha's findings weren't found until mid-2010. This was in 2002, and we know that after this, she went to investigate the Lebedev murders. So she didn't disappear here when she went to the necropolis. If the end visuals we see where we're backtracking out of it are any indication, after she spoke to her brother, she left. So why then were her findings not found until mid-2010? And then, as it says, why were they classified until 2024? It seems whoever's documenting this, perhaps the police station or some other investigator, is seeing what we have seen and is beginning to doubt Martha's true identity. During this ending, we also hear the song Death Song by Robbie Basho begin to play. The song is about someone who is ready to meet death and is embracing it almost as a comfort. As a matter of fact, the description for this video that reads, "Towards the midnight sun, I am riding, riding home," is lyrics from the Death Song. With the last song that was used, The Boy with the Gun, I said that would turn out to be indicative of the flutist. And now we start to see how that makes sense. The Boy with the Gun is about someone who's hateful, who despises life, and wants others to suffer because of how they have suffered. And now with everything we've seen with Madhouse up until this point, that makes sense. He committed himself over to this being, became a monstrous figure, and is dragging others to the drowned city. So if that song was indicative of the flutist, then perhaps this song, the death song, could be indicative of Martha. It's a song about someone who is waiting for death, who wants it to come for them. Perhaps Martha, seeing what happened to her husband Ethan, a husband who probably had no idea of how long Martha's been alive or of her true nature. And then all the other death and destruction that's happened around her. I mean, she became an investigator seemingly to try to stop this from happening. Perhaps she's ready to end it all, even if that means herself, even if that means her immortality. All of these are questions we'll ask ourselves more of and elaborate more on after our last video. Now, there's technically two videos on the channel before this. There's another VHS tale. This one is called A Wasp Nest, and it's a really cool little horror project that, again, is expertly done with its visuals and its storytelling and its pacing. It's about an MKUltra experiment where the government is trying to convince people to effectively act as mindless drones or a wasp in a wasp nest. And they do it using a flower that only blooms once every 38 years. It seems to have these psychoactive properties. And it's a really cool video you should go check out for yourself. But as far as I can tell, it doesn't have a connection to the greater Oakburn Opus story. The Starving Five and the Circles did because of the connections we talked about earlier and the fact they're in the same region. But I'm not going to cover A Wasp Nest just to not bog down the pacing of the current storyline we're chasing. However, I highly recommend you check it out. I will have it linked as its own video in the description. Because, I mean, you got to save something for yourself. Even if you get the whole Oakburn Opus storyline spoiled for you in this video, you can at least go watch his cool MKUltra horror story. Then after that, there's a trailer for Oakburn Opus, which we'll talk about in a bit. So for now, let's get to what is at this point the most recent upload on the Red Diamond channel, Oakburn Opus Lies. See, this one breaks the part 1, 2, and 3 convention because it's almost a sort of breakaway story. It, of course, ties into the Oakburn Opus narrative, but it tracks something we haven't really thought about yet. What became of some of the people affected by the 1997 disappearance? And how do they connect to what we've seen so far? Well, we're about to find out right now. Lies opens with the screen fading in. Once again, wind instruments can be heard. You see what appears to be two tombstones in the bare terrain. Once again, red text appears. What do you wager? I might win him yet. If you give me your permission first, I'll lead him gently on the road I set. Again, this is red text, and it seems to be a conversation perhaps between Marv P.S. and the Serpent or some other supernatural entity, wagering that he can lead someone down his path. It also invokes musings of the biblical story of Job. When the devil went to God and asked for God's permission to torment Job because he believed that Job would turn towards him, the devil. It's not a direct one-to-one, but the phrasing seemed reminiscent. After this, we're shown the inside of someone's home. Someone who, it seems, is investigating the disappearance at Lake Oakburn. And we see that they're on the right track. Not only do they have the sigils of both the flutist and Martha, but they have images of the Pied Piper as well as several runes. The circle, the two inverted triangles, and a line. And on the center of a desk in front of this is a gun. Whoever this is receiving a phone call from Martha. The other artifacts around the phone paint a disturbing picture. He has two discounts for funeral services, as well as a gun with one bullet. We then see a transcript of the message that Martha left this person. The cassette tape says that this was recorded in December of 2003. That should set off some bells because that is the same time as the Lebedev murders. And also, after Martha visited the drowned city. It seems that the person whose room we just saw and Martha is trying to call is named Carter. As Martha says, Carter, listen to me. You're making a mistake. The interspliced shots of a car driving to Lake Oakburn tells us that Martha was probably calling this person to keep them from going there. She continues, talk to me. Don't you dare turn away. Don't you dare listen to him. I told you I'm working on it. For God's sakes, Carter, answer the phone. Just where the hell are you? What the hell were you thinking with that message? Stay away, Anthony, please. Don't follow the melody. And as Anthony Carter continues to Lake Oakburn, we get our title card once again for Oakburn Opus Lies. So it seems that despite Martha's protest, Carter is traveling back to Lake Oakburn for some reason. If that was his house we saw, he's been obsessed with this case for some time. But now he's seemingly following him and the melody, which we can assume to be the flutist. And if that's the case, then the conversation we saw at the beginning was likely between the flutist and perhaps the serpent asking permission to lure Carter in. We're taking to part one, Call on the Wind. This takes us back and shows us how Carter got here in the first place. You see a series of messages that Carter's received. 1997, I'm deeply sorry for your loss. Such a terrible thing. My deepest condolences, Carter. My thoughts are with you during this difficult time. In 2000, and what an endless grief have their departure caused. I shall pray for you. I'll pray for us and all the lost. 2001, where have you been, man? We often talk about you. Left your office intact, you know, for when you decide to come back. Then in 2002, time heals all wounds, Anthony. You ought to hold on tight. To which, to these condolences, we seemingly get Anthony's response when he says, on December 3rd, 2003, time didn't heal a thing. As he says this, we can also hear the audio of a revolver cylinder spinning. Now, the first time I saw this, I thought this was a cool, like, tough guy moment where he's decided he's going to go back to Oakburn and kill whatever's responsible for this. But then as the next few scenes continue, we keep hearing the cylinder spin and the trigger get pulled a single time before it spins again. And that, in combination with the one bullet we saw on the desk, tells us that Anthony is playing Russian roulette. And what I initially thought was a cool good guy who's going to go hunt down the monster was actually something very depressing, and I completely missed the vibe. We see a series of the tombstones we saw earlier on a hillside. Text tells us again that all 1,043 residents of Old Oakburn disappeared overnight. As hope of ever finding them withered, the people built cenotaphs, stone memorials raised in the mountains. As their names disappear from our conversations, another monolith is built in their memory. Today, there are 900 cenotaphs. And we see the two from the intro once again. As Anthony tells us, yesterday, two more were built. See, Anthony lost his wife, Catherine, and his daughter, Ashley, in the disappearance. He wasn't in Oakburn when the disappearance took place, and for the past 6 years, he has suffered with the guilt that he couldn't keep his family safe. And whatever tragic thing happened to them happened without him. All this is being said as the revolver cylinder spins. Anthony says as time moved on, people moved on, and hope faded, but he can't let it go. He says, we all felt the wind shift uncannily that night. We all dreamt of those symbols. Something took them. A call on the wind. But I fear my strength is failing, and I will never stare into those empty graves again. Confirming my idea earlier that the bargain was in reference to Anthony, the mourning father, a serpent appears on screen and the red text appears again. See the father. He grieves and withers. His mind a fiery sun. As he seeks a spirit of death, thunders draw close, and a shadow halts at the door. Sure enough, as Anthony pulls an empty trigger once again, this time a heavy knock falls on the door. As he glances towards the door, a shadow moves away, and he finds a box left on the front step. This seems to be the first step in whatever is trying to lure him back to the lake. Inside was a VHS tape with an upright triangle drawn on it, and a letter with no signature other than an 8-pointed star on its front. Interestingly, on the table, along with the stuff he just received, Anthony also has a copy of Faust. Faust being the famous play about a man who made a deal with the devil, something that, in Anthony's investigation, he might have tied to Marvius. As would be fitting, because as we know now, Madhouse gave his soul for the life of his sister. Even if Anthony doesn't know the true nature of that yet, he's starting to catch on. The letter reads as follows. I am part of that power which eternally wills evil and eternally works good. Death is a guest whose visit is never fully celebrated. My gift, a piece of me, to show you what no man has seen. Beneath it is Madhouse's seal. So, to see this supposed gift, Anthony plays the tape. The tape opens with shapes spinning in the same way Martha saw shapes when she went down into the drowned city. Here, however, the circles and octagons are removed, and we now just have squares, at least initially until the red circles begin to emanate from their center, fading and obscuring as if we are looking into water. The first thing we see is the Ludolf family banner. Family banners were used in old times to indicate aspects or sigils or signs or memorabilia of a family. And we know the Ludolphs to be the true last name of Madhouse and Martha. We know thus far that Madhouse, or the flutist, is indicated by an upside-down triangle, and Martha is depicted by an upright triangle. While on the banner we see on the left side, the upside-down triangle shows once again the Pied Piper, and the upright triangle on the right shows Justice, the visage of the blind woman holding the scales. This is further confirmed by in the middle of the image, we see both of their respective sigils. And this tracks with everything we've seen thus far. It's fitting that Martha would be represented by Justice, since she seems to be doing everything she's doing now to make this right, or to stop whatever powers are at hand that led to the disappearance of these people. But there's some other things we see on this banner as well. For one, near the top of the image, we see a serpent. And at the bottom, we see two wolves. The serpent's likely indicative of the viper, the thing that led them down this path, or at least gave Madhouse his power in the first place, and the two wolves could be representative of the two twins. However, at the top of the image, at the Ludolph name, we see an upside-down triangle with a line through it. We'll talk about what that might mean later. But for now, it seems the flutist is giving Carter all of the things he's been searching for. We know from the drawings on the pinboard he was trying to connect the dots between what the sigils mean, what all these connections could be. Now the flutist, in order to lure him in, is giving him just that. So from the next slide, we see that this tape is the Book of Marv P.S. 1, in a statement by Professor Fyodor Petrov Lebedev from Lower Saxony in 1864. Now this is interesting for a lot of reasons. For one, we're about to see the first Book of Marv P.S. that will give us more context to the history of all this. But also, it seems to be put together by Professor Lebedev. The same last name as Alex Lebedev, who again was killed in the Starving Five, and the two Lebedev murders seem to be a focal point for a lot of the things we're witnessing. It also says this was recorded in Lower Saxony in 1864. Region in Germany. The Ludolph name is Germanic, so it's likely when this was recorded, it was by someone who knew the Ludolphs when the twins would have been 12 years old. So with that, let's look at the first Book of Marv P.S. See a woman sitting in a chair with an upside-down triangle and a line through it on her back. This is the same image we saw at the top of the Ludolph banner earlier. The text says, "A grieving parent is most conducive cosmic forces." This is also ironically targeted at Carter himself, as he is a grieving parent who is about to give way to cosmic forces because of his grief. We then see a strange depiction of what appears to be Marv P.S. or some horned creature fighting a skeleton, a representation of death as a viper watches. And thus she bargained with the keen serpent, should her redeem her motherhood on the shores of the Weser River. The Weser River is in North Germany. And it seems that this woman made a deal with the serpent in order to save her children. A deal that was made on the shore of the river. And the water turned crimson as the blood of our children sunk below. The covenant was fulfilled. And raised were the object of our grief, the twins. And we see two children, a boy and a girl, represented by an upright triangle and an upside down triangle. We then once again, if it isn't clear enough, see the visage of the Pied Piper and Justice attributed to the sigils of Madhouse and Martha. This tells us that it's likely the fate of the twins was sealed far before they had any say in it. Seems the two of them drowned in the river, and their mother, perhaps a witch or just familiar with dark rituals, made a deal. She bargained with the serpent so that her children may be brought back. But the text continues and says, "Yet the compact commands the sorcerer's willingness. The bargain commands veneration. Contrarily, the viper won't sink its teeth." So because the sorcerer, or the mother, or the witch, made this deal with the serpent, she pledged her allegiance to it. Much like how many years later, Madhouse would do the same when his sister died in a lake once again. Either Martha's quite clumsy around water, or the serpent has used her life to trick the Ludolph family for his purposes time and time again. The book says, "Symbols speak the language of our faiths, and we're given some clarification to several of the shapes we've seen thus far. The circle, representing the cycle and the obsession, the triangle, representing fire, the inverted triangle, representing water, and the line, representing the bond." Now, this symbolism of the triangles representing elements isn't unique to this series. It's popular within occultism for four different variations of the triangle to represent the four elements. Upright being fire, inverted being water, as seen here. But upright with a line through it represents air, and inverted with a line through it represents Earth. Keep in mind, inverted with a line through it is the same thing we saw on their mother as well as at the top of the family banner. This symbolism is something that gets used in everything from occultism to alchemy to things like Wiccan practices in the West. The unity of the elements often being represented by a pentagram or a six-sided star. You may already be drawing some conclusions. Madhouse's symbol is water 9 times within a circle that represents cycle or obsession. And Martha's is the symbol of fire connected by the bond to 9 circles. Again, a symbol of cycle or obsession. We'll talk about this more later, but what's happening here literally, again, is Carter is given his answers. The video continues. In their covenant, the serpent would grant power to those who venerate it. Power to defy death. Power to reunite life and death. One can only speculate about the sorcerer's mental state. But as for the Ludolf, with all due respect, I wish to refrain from discussing her personal tragedies. Truth is, the serpent is alluring. Elixir vitae, oozing from the viper's fangs. Elixir vitae is Latin for the elixir of life. This confirms for us that the Lebedev, the professor who wrote this original text, knew the Ludolf twins and knew the mother who lost them and made the deal with the serpent, saying that he doesn't want to discuss her personal tragedies and defending her by saying the viper's offer is alluring. I mean, the serpent has the power to give life. What kind of grieving parent wouldn't want that? Which is the exact reason the flutist is showing Carter this now. And then seemingly, Marfpia speaks to Carter directly. She cries your name every night. The little one, come to the lake. Here my forces lay strong. Should you wish to dry her tears, the sigil is key. You know which one. As an inverted red triangle emanates behind the text. From here, the tape ends, and Carter's decision's pretty clear. He was told from this tape that the serpent has the power to give life. And now he's told that his daughter cries his name at night, crying for him. I mean, a man who is about to take his own life because he couldn't live without her, what else is he going to do? So we then hear a voicemail that Carter left for Martha, the same voicemail she referenced at the beginning of this video. In his message to Martha, who Martha was the lead investigator working the case, Carter says, Martha, I'm tired. I know you try. We all know how good you are at finding people. But to me, your words just don't have any meaning anymore. You say you'll fix things, look away and frown, and with a cold stare you return to the same old condolences. Is there really anything inside you? Behind that husk? I found the damn solution. Or maybe the solution found me. It doesn't matter. So don't worry about lying anymore. I know those symbols have great power. I'll fix it myself. I'll save my family. To which Carter leaves for Old Oakburn, and Martha replies with the message we heard at the beginning of Lies. Fittingly, a depiction of the Piper is shown once again as Carter drives to Oakburn. We see how more and more cenotaphs are added to the countryside as more and more people lose hope. Then amongst them, on the hillside, Marfpia stands, awaiting his new disciple of Carter. We see pictures of Anthony and his wife, depicted as two swans, deeply in love, and then their daughter, Ashley. Marfpia continues to speak. Journey home had all the black stones turned to him, a grimace in each, and a judging stare. We see more artifacts of the disappearance, a newspaper from after the disappearance, an IPD missing persons poster. Which, yeah, sure, it shows Catherine and Ashley, which is the point. But if we look to the left, we see that someone named Melissa Byme doesn't have a face. I guess you could say the exposure was too high that it blurred out her face. But if you look at that image, to me, she doesn't have a face. I don't know what that means or what to do with that. But that's weird. If I had a nickel for every time I was covering an internet horror story and someone in the background of an image didn't have a face and it was never explained, I would have 2 nickels. The other time that happened was during the Monument Mythos. You're welcome for not making you try to find it. Anthony drives back to his old home, a home he likely hasn't been to since his wife and daughter disappeared. The house is in disrepair. Windows remain broken, a pile of dirt with a pickaxe in the front yard. We're now taken to part 2 titled Blue Crystal Fire. Blue Crystal Fire is the title of another song by Robbie Basho, the same singer who sung the song in the last Oakburn Opus video, and this song appears at the end of this video. The song is about someone wanting to be reunited with their lover who will wipe their tears away. So now that Marv P.S. has effectively made Carter want to have what he's offering, he's now about to offer him the thing that will damn him. Carter walks through the empty and dark house all the way to his daughter's room. When he gets to her room, the door opens on its own. Carved into the door itself is an upright triangle. Carter says, "And all of her things stood still, perfect to memory." It seems that Ashley was an artist, drawing pictures of ladies and swans. He looks down at her desk, and while the main thing we see is a journal with the swan in front of it, I also want to point out the wolf plushie to the left. For one, the wolf symbols come up a couple of times. On the Ludolf family banner, there were two wolves shown at the base of it, possibly representing the twins. And John Doe described Marv Pius as lichen-shaped or wolf-shaped. But on a sweeter note, or more tragic note, I want to point out that the wolf plushie we see here is the same plushie next to Carter's television when he was watching the tape earlier, meaning that one of the only memorabilia of his daughter that he had with him was the matching wolf plushie. Perhaps the plushie he gifted her one year as a father and daughter thing. Her plushie now sitting on the desk watching him as he opens her notebook. The next segment of the video being from that same notebook, or Ashley's diary, taken October 1997. From the 3rd to the 7th of October, we hear about events that we've heard some depiction of up until now, but this time with Ashley's illustrations and perspective. Cold and foggy morning. The wind blew softly as an outsider stumbled upon our gates. Hunched and cloaked, he came towards us, deeply injured. Our people took him in, treated his nasty wounds, and offered him refuge. He is tall and thin. He towers over any crowd and shines at the touch of the sun. From his dark cloak, he withdrew a flute. It is enchanting, unlike anything else. So we gathered around the fire, and they all danced from night to morning and from morning to night. Sometimes the tall figure danced too. In these illustrations, we see everything from the townsfolk gathered around to hear him play to them dancing around him, some sort of idol casting down a glare upon them. He stays here. He roams the night, spreading melody through the avenues, soothing the ill, the children, and all folks into mighty, peaceful sleep. In anxious nights, he calms my heart. And then, on October 8th, this morning, he insisted on accompanying me on a walk in the woods. He said he wished to protect me from any hungry wolves. We were looking for the forget-me-nots and fireweeds and all the pretty flowers that blossomed around. Most of the time, he'd follow silently, but then the wind would blow around us and I'd understand his words. He says he was here a long time ago, that he saw some of the old houses being built when old Oakburn was not old. He led the people here. The settlement thrived. But then came times of wrath, and all was consumed in a great fire. This hints more at things we've heard about previously, when the great viper's wrath was known. He leaves, he says. He carries his loss to a very dark and gloomy place he wishes I would never see. But it was all done now. The past could not be redeemed. Would you like to see something beautiful? He said. We walked out of the woods to the shore of the lake. We see some depictions of Marv Pius that are far more detailed than anything we've got thus far. We see the scales and the fish-like details of his head. In spite of this ghastly appearance, no one has ever mentioned fear at this appearance. It's as if the trance that came with the flute did more than entice their ears. And on the lake swims a beautiful white swan, as in my dreams and the beautiful images that came from his flute. Dad says the lake is barren. There's no fish and no animals drink there. No life could exist in those waters. But the flutist says he and death walk side by side. This is followed by several glimpses of the recording from the day of the disappearance and photographs of Lake Oakburn. Flutist walks hand in hand with death indeed. This entire segment is so, so good. The drawings are indicative of medieval artwork depicting witchcraft and ceremony. The drawing of the people dancing around the flutist is like that of the dancing plague. The horned figure standing above the young girl calls upon everything from satanic imagery to ancient depictions of satyrs and other creatures from mythology. That in combination with the child's narration and the music box we hear as it's being narrated, it does such a great job at mythologizing this entire setting. It's making it something older than the town and the people and the memories of the area. As she said, he led the people here to settle Old Oakburn in the first place. There's some grand plan here that can never have been stopped. This monster and this creature is the stuff of legend, and Red Diamond does a great job at interpreting that. After this, we see the conversation in a transcript from October 9th, one day before the magnum opus or the disappearance of the townspeople. This is the Carter family's last recorded call. It seems that he was out on a job and there was an accident at work. So now Anthony's going to have to be gone for the weekend. He knows that Ashley is going to be disappointed by this, so he tells his wife to tell her that he'll get her some of those colored pencils she's been wanting. Then ends by saying, tell her dad will bring her some of those as an apology, and tell her I love her. The last things he would ever say to his wife before they were gone forever, or at least gone until now. The phone conversation rubs salt in the wound further. You might have been asking, well, if the whole town disappeared, why didn't Anthony? And it's simply because he wasn't home when the disappearance took place. He's likely one of the only residents of the town who survived, and he's been living with the consequences of that ever since. That night, as Carter is still in his old family home, Marfia speaks again. The clock strike 12, towards the attic, there in which he will bargain the weight of his grief. Carter has set up a sort of altar with pictures of his wife and daughter, and, just as Marfius commanded, drawn the sigil onto the floor. As I said earlier, sigils are often used as calling cards or a way to summon a specific entity who you want a favor or answers from. Carter is now using that in a ritual to call onto Marfius so that he can see his family again. Carter kneels before the altar and the candles and says, "To what do I kneel? I see your symbols. I acknowledge your divinity. I do not seek retaliation. See, devotion. And I shall only ask one thing in return. The lives of my family. Free them." The sigil behind him lights on fire. "Dispose of mine as you see fit, but free my child. Free them both and keep me instead. I beg you." The ghostly garb, cloaked in sheets, of his wife and child stand by their altar. Fire ignites the room. "I can no longer bear it. Whatever you be, I've seen your light. I've answered your call. Talk to me, Lord of Rats. Talk to me." And with this cry, for a moment, he hears a woman breathe and turns to see Marfpius outside of the window. His text appears that says, "Follow the melody." I gotta say, this whole sequence, first time I watched it, hit so hard, and even now it's one of the coolest moments I've ever seen in a YouTube horror project. Like the sigil and the fire showing up and him begging and then their ghost appearing. That line, "Lord of Rats," got to me in a way too, because one of the most popular names you hear given to Lucifer is Beelzebub, or the Lord of the Flies. So Marfpius being referred to as the Lord of the Rats is fittingly satanic. And now he has someone who's willing to pledge his life and soul for the sake of his family. And Marfpius, as we see, is far too eager to answer. And also, it's just shot so well. Like, that breathe and the way the camera turned, and then you see the figure move out of the window, but then you see the entire hallway, how it's shaped like an upright triangle. Just the colors and the sets and the camera movement, it all works so well. Again, I mentioned long legs earlier, but that camera turn and the way that a lot of the scenes, especially in Lies, are framed, almost feels like a Wes Anderson flick. The way the camera is so impartial to the setting and just rotates on a tripod. And again, I know a lot of these sets are digital, but it's the cinematography style that the digital landscape is invoking. And it does such a great job at establishing a dreamlike quality to the scares we're seeing. Again, Red Diamond is such a talented filmmaker, and he's doing this whole thing by himself. As Anthony makes his way to the lake, Marfpius continues. "Where are you, Anthony, whose anguish cries drew towards me with all your force? You begged my presence. You implored my voice. Now hearken to my melody. Seek the wind. Impart your wail unto me. Once so prosperous in your love, would you like to rejoin them? Anthony, now standing on the lake, willing to offer himself up, says to Marvpius, "Instruct me." Marvpius appears before him, and their conversation goes as follows. "The exit shall remain sealed until our unification. For ghosts and conjurers, the same laws appertain. The same way they enter in, they must go out."
"What? But I beg you, how should they be of any use? She was only..."
"I have use in you. Thus, I tempt you to a compact of much value."
"How?"
"You'll join them. May you rest united in their slumber beneath these waters. Should you resign your flesh, relinquish your body, upon fulfilled covenant, I shall raise you as a vessel." "Is that hesitancy? You failed as their protector once. I now offer you the faculty to redeem your fatherhood. You sought a spirit of death, and I have come. Unite or persist in your own misery."
"I accept."
The image of Carter here is now inverted. True Carter is upside down, and what stands is his reflection cast upon the water, cast above the drowned city. We see flashes of shapes, the Ludolf banner once again, image of Marvpius fighting death, and we see the monolith, the sigil, the tombstone, the entryway of Marvpius once more glow red. And for a brief glimpse, we see two messages presented backwards. If we mirror this image, we see that it's two letters Anthony wrote to his wife and daughter. I believe these letters to be the final messages he wanted to send to his wife and daughter before he gave himself as a vessel. First reads, "Kath, I'm deeply sorry, my dear, but I've tried it again, and it did not happen today. I am ashamed. I should be in those woods, and I should scream your names until my throat burns and bleeds, and I should hike and search for you and our little girl until my legs fall apart. But I'm afraid I'm losing my strength and see no other option. I hope you forgive me, darling, even if I don't deserve it. If not, tell me, how should I stay here living in shame as you wither in some dark place, your name forgotten day after day? May I join you and our princess in his great city soon. With love, Anthony." To his daughter, "Hi, princess. I've looked through your drawings today, and in tears I imagined how beautiful they would look in color. You are talented and full of light. I just hope you'd grow to show the world all that light. But you were not allowed to grow. You were not. And I will pray every day that the most beautiful angels stand guard at your everlasting rest, because you deserve what is best in this life and beyond it. Love you forever, Dad." Marvpius said a lot there that's interesting. Things like conjurers and spirits must leave the same way they entered. That the two of them must be unified, and that upon completion of it, he can rest with his wife and daughter. We'll talk about that later, but we're almost at the end now. As a matter of fact, we're in our last part of our final upload. Part 3, The Boy with the Gun. When I saw the title for this part, I got so hyped. Like I said, the title was a mainstay in Part 2, the part around the Lebedev murders. That's about to become really relevant right now. After the encounter, Carter wandered the mountain for 5 days, allegedly in a deranged state of mind. December 10th, 2003. Carter comes across the Lebedev residence. Anthony Carter was John Doe from Part 2. All we knew then was that someone came under Marv Pierce's influence and went to this house to murder the two brothers, but now we see who it was and why. He gave himself over to Marvpius because there was nothing left to do, because even if it was death, it was better than living without his wife and daughter. And that is the influence Marvpius used to make use of Carter to kill these brothers. We still don't know why Marvpius wanted these brothers dead. Now we know what he did to get them dead. This is such a great twist. Maybe if you're experiencing this story for the first time through this video, you caught on because of like the pickaxe outside of the Carter house that was used in the Lebedev killings, or how I emphasized that this was in December of 2003, the same month as the Lebedev murders. But when I was watching this for the first time, that completely blindsided me. But I love how much that makes sense, and I love how much this entry is giving context to something that
from an objective standpoint, isn't that important? Like, we could just hear that some random person got possessed and committed the murders, and it'd be fine if it left it at that, but fleshing it out so much makes it so much more impactful. We see the murders depicted once again. We see their bodies lying dead on the darkroom floor. And then, as we saw in part two, Carter called the police and confessed to the murder. But now with this context, we know that Martha was speaking to Carter before the murders took place, leading to her text here that says, "What have you done?" So from her perspective, Carter called her and said that he was going to follow the flutist. She couldn't get a hold of him. And then he calls the police and said he was the one that killed the Lebedevs. We then see more photographs and illustrations of the murder. So the text says, "What will it be then, Martha?" Martha says, "Our people are fed up with these nightmares. Take them to the lake and stay out of sight. Make sure they sink. Just give me a few minutes." We see pictures of Oliver and Jackson's body. And arrestingly, both are depicted with an upside down triangle. This could simply be because they were ultimately victims of the flutist. Martha continues, "Carter is emptied. No, this is not Carter. Not anymore. I'll deal with him." We also see an image of Carter. However, Carter is depicted with an upright triangle. If the upright triangle is a symbol of Martha, then maybe by deal with him, Martha killed him, realizing that he was now just a vessel for the flutist, and that it'd be more humane to put him out of his misery and stop him from hurting anyone else. This context of Martha having the police throw the bodies into the bottom of the lake makes sense now with what we heard at the end of part two, how the killer said he had hit him with a pickaxe and shot him, but that didn't match with the evidence with the body showing sign of drowning. But if Martha was trying to hide the bodies to keep people from knowing about how terrible things were here and about the supernatural goings on, but if Martha was trying to hide people from the truth of what was really happening here, then that makes sense of why the bodies would have waterlogged damage. Now, you could theorize that perhaps Martha is acting on behalf of the flutist or the serpent or Marv P.S. Because if Marv P.S. is trying to bring people to the lake, then maybe she just threw two people into the lake. I mean, this is after she went to the drowned city, after all. But I don't think so, because if that was the case, why would she kill Carter? Like, if that guy's a vessel that it took that much time for him to fully commit himself to Marv P.S., then if she was working with him, she'd just leave him around. The one thing that is weird, though, is it didn't just say in part two that the bodies were found with water damage. It said they had pulmonary injury. In other words, they breathed water in. So were the Lebedev brothers half alive when they were thrown into the lake? Or in the midst of this, somehow Carter did something to resurrect them, and it was their resurrected form that was drowned in the lake. Who knows? But Martha accurately realized that Carter wasn't Carter anymore, and instead was just a vessel. When an image of Martha Astor appears, "See the Astor. Her stare is empty, and she rewrites our tragedies that night. In their paper, she writes the brothers drowned and sunk. That night, in her condolences, she says Anthony Carter laid face down in blood with five bullets in his chamber and another in his head. She lies. She lies because no lamb shall fear any wolves, for all the wolves have drowned. But in truth, only one wolf drowned. Didn't it, Martha? We have overstayed our welcome. The only path for redemption is our destruction." We see the image once again of the Piper and Justice, and for a few frames, we see the depiction of their mother once again, this time enclosed within a circle of obsession and the cycle. The end words that Marv P.S. said to Martha are interesting. For one, it seems that all the stuff about, well, the brothers actually drowned was made up by Martha. The murder was brutal. She didn't want people to know about it, so she had the bodies thrown in the water so that she could say it was just a drowning accident. And then similarly, she lied about Carter as well. It seems she shot Carter and then said he only had five bullets left in the gun. In other words, claiming that Carter took his own life. As Marv P.S. says, she is rewriting history, rewriting their tragedies so that the sheep will not fear the wolves. But then he says, only one wolf drowned, didn't it, Martha? The only person we know of so far who has drowned was her. I mean, it was her drowning that led to Madhouse selling his soul to save her. I theorized in the last part that maybe Martha's coming to the conclusion that they should be ended, that they shouldn't live forever. But here, it seems that Marv P.S. has came to the same conclusion, saying that they have overstayed their welcome. Now, perhaps Marv Pius is just saying they've overstayed their welcome in the land of the living, and he's trying to get her to join him in the necropolis. And also, it's not like Marv Pius is a figure that can be trusted from everything we've seen thus far. I mean, this entire last section was about him manipulating a grieving father to get his will. But it's interesting that he seems to be coming to the conclusion that, as he said, they've overstayed their welcome. Maybe Martha's intentions aren't as pure as we might think. Sure, it seems the stuff she's doing is to keep the public safe and to try to keep people from knowing about how disastrous this world of the unseen really is. But maybe she has her own ulterior motives that we don't know about yet, but her brother does. For now, that's all we have of the Oakburn Opus series. But with that, there's some things I want to talk about. First of all, let's establish a general timeline for all this. The first event that seems to have any significance for us is the twins being born in 1857. There's a mention in the second book of Marv Pius about two miracles being born. This potentially refers to them. So while we know their mother did a ritual to save them years later, especially given their mother's ties to witchcraft, there's a chance there was something special about them from the beginning. By 1864, Professor Lebedev writes a commentary about the book of Marv Pius I. So by 1864, the twins have drowned and been resurrected. But it also hints that perhaps Marv Pius and the serpent and these legends at play are much, much older than our story. Then in 1897, when Martha is killed again, Madhouse makes the bargain for his soul for her life, and on that, seemingly, he is transformed into Marv Pius, or the flutist, and Old Oakburn is founded. From there, supernatural findings become regular in the area. In the 80s, we have events like the Circles and the Starving Five. Also, during this time, Martha was living in the town and seemingly married a local. Someone who was so local, in fact, that his brother, Gary Astor, lived in the town as well. However, both of them, as we saw, were killed or consumed by supernatural forces. In October of 1997, the flutist arrives at Oakburn and entices everyone with his flute. By the end of the month, all 1,034 residents would disappear. By 2002, Martha has become a detective and decided to travel alone to Old Oakburn. It's there that she visits the drowned city, speaks to her brother in the form of the flutist, and then leaves with this newfound knowledge and seemingly a desire to stop this from happening. 1 year later, in 2003, Marv Pius seduces Carter to give himself as a vessel, and then that vessel is used to kill the Lebedev brothers, a murder which Martha hides from the community at large by staging it as a drowning accident. Then there's a huge gap in time, and we know that Martha's things were recovered in 2010, meaning sometime between 2003 and 2010, she must go missing. Perhaps returning to the drowned city as Marv Pius wanted to do when he spoke through John Doe, or as we know now, Anthony Carter. Which, with this further context, the conversation from part two makes more sense. Because at the end of part two, when Anthony Carter's possessed, he says the only reason he's speaking to Martha is to call her back to the drowned city. But we know from part three she's already seen the drowned city once in 2002. So it seems that after she left, Marv Pius is now beckoning her to return. This might be because of what we see at the end of Lies, when Marv Pius says they've overstayed their welcome. Perhaps Madhouse or Marv Pius or whatever is speaking through this form at this point wants the cycle to end, but for some reason, Martha wants to see it through. We don't know enough about Martha yet to know her true motivations. Perhaps she is grief-stricken by the loss of her husband and the damage that these supernatural beings have brought upon the towns. Or perhaps she is overstaying her welcome and refuses to die. But like I said earlier, the flutist isn't one to be trusted. Which, the flutist has an interesting title in himself, right? And that name, Marv Pius. Well, out of any religion or cultist belief, there isn't a flute player named Marv Pius, but there is one named Marcius. Marcius was a satyr, or in other words, a half-human, half-goat. Marcius was said to be he who invented the music of the flute. As legend has it, one day Athena, while playing the flute, an invention of the gods, saw that it made her cheeks puff up whenever she played. In disgust, she threw the flute away, to which it was found by a lowly satyr named Marcius. Marcius picked up the flute and became quite good at it, playing wherever he went, and those who would hear would learn of the flute. Marcius either became so great at this, or his ego became so large, that he decided to challenge a god. So he goes to the god Apollo, known for playing the lyre, and Marcius says he can play the flute better than Apollo can play the lyre. So they have a competition on whatever terms Apollo wants, and as they're playing, they're both quite good. It seems to even be a draw. That is, until Apollo begins to sing as he plays. Something that, of course, a flute player can't do.
and other renditions of the tell, Apollo asks that they play their instruments upside down. Again, something not great for a flute player. So Marsyas loses, and as punishment for attempting to challenge a god, Apollo has him skinned alive. Some renditions of the story, the skin is used to make a wine sack. To be filleted, he was tied to a tree near a lake, and then when they were done, Apollo turned the satyr into a stream, a living embodiment of water. In the Oakburn Opus series trailer that Red Diamond posted right before Lies came out, the opening snippet is a short summary of the Marsyas myth. So does this mean that Marsyas is the same satyr from Greek myth? I don't think so, but I think it's meant to invoke it. From what we know now, Marsyas is more an amalgamated form of fish and scale and horns and humanity, what little's left. But on first appearance, he certainly looks like a satyr, like a goat man. And a goat man that plays the flute is no incident. It clearly draws to the Greek legend. The takeaway most people have from the Marsyas legend is that of hubris. Marsyas thought himself so wise and so powerful that he could beat the gods at their own game. So perhaps something similar happened with Madhouse. We know that he and his sister from a young age were condemned to a supernatural future given their resurrection, but perhaps Martha turned away from this upbringing while Madhouse fell into it. After all, in the first book of Marsyas, we learn that the sorcerer has to be dedicated to the serpent, and that great power can come from this dedication to cheat death and unite life and death. And what did Marsyas say to Ashley Carter on the banks of Lake Oakburn? That he walks hand in hand with death. So perhaps Martha tried to leave the life and Madhouse embraced his witchhood, ultimately making a deal that signed away his fate. Perhaps he thought himself powerful enough to best the serpent or to overcome this bargain, just as Marsyas thought he could outplay Apollo. That's not the only place in this series that symbols seem important. The most obvious one is the sigils. As far as I've been able to find, none of the Ludolf sigils match any real world or like occult belief sigils. There's a ton of sigils for different gods and spirits and entities, but the upside down triangles in the circle and the triangle with the nine circles doesn't seem to be any of them. But we can put together what this sigil means based off stuff we see in the series. As I mentioned earlier, it's a practice within occultism for the triangles to represent different elements. And Madhouse fittingly has an upside down triangle representing water. This makes sense not only because Madhouse, now as Marsyas, is at the bottom of the drowned city, but also because, as I mentioned in the original Marsyas legend, he is ultimately turned into water. The elements can symbolize a ton of things in occultism, but water often symbolizes emotions. This might be fitting if Madhouse made an emotional decision when he lost his sister to sign away his soul and eventually the lives of thousands of people forever. His sigil depicts nine water logos. Nine also has significance within occultism, most often representing the end of something or the cycle. That's because nine is the highest number you can get to before your numbers become two other numbers together. Nine is at the end of basic numerology. And once again, that seems fitting for everything we've seen in Madhouse. Again, we're not sure where he stands in this, if he wants the cycle to be over. I mean, seemingly he does by saying they've overstayed their welcome. But if this is a cycle, what does that mean? Does that mean Madhouse has died several times before or done this in several different towns? Or does it mean Marsyas, the spirit within him, has done this before, that Madhouse is just another vessel, just how Anthony Carter was just another vessel? Importantly, his nine triangles are seen within a circle that the series tells us can either represent the cycle or obsession. If the symbolism of nine is to be believed, then perhaps his circle does mean the cycle and Madhouse's persistence in ensuring it. Then we have Martha's sigil, from the beginning of Beering all the way back in part two. This symbol represents an upright triangle, or in other words, fire. Fire often represents purity, power, or strength. This idea of pure strength could be identified as justice, something that is fitting considering Martha's symbol on the family banner was that of justice. And again, Madhouse's was the Pied Piper, which, you know, obvious symbolism is obvious. Pied Piper shows up to town, plays a flute, and all the kids disappear. What does that sound like? Martha is represented by the image of fire connected to nine circles. Now, if the circle means the cycle or obsession, does that mean her justice has an obsessive quality? We know that a line represents a bond, so there's a bond between her, the fire, and this obsession, or perhaps her and the cycle. Maybe Martha isn't immortal in the way I perceive, and that she's just been alive since the 1800s. Maybe she's died and been resurrected time and time again. Maybe through her own body, or maybe through rebirth. Either way, it's something that, according to Marsyas,
needs to end. There's also a physical mention of nine circles earlier. I believe it was in the book of 2nd Marvpius. Specifically, it's in the 10th stanza of the 2nd book of Marvpius where it says, "Roar the fire from nine circles and let the water boil." Now, this roaming the fire from nine circles is very indicative of Dante's Inferno, the idea of hell being broken into nine parts. We haven't got a clear clarification, and we may never, as to what the nature of these supernatural beings is, if they are demonic or if they're just spiritual or some other supernatural or alien presence in a Lovecraft sense. You know, the idea that these are beings from dimensions we can't even comprehend. But if they are expressly demonic, then perhaps that's what the nine circles refers to. It is a direct connection to hell, and therefore, Martha, symbol of fire, has a connection to the nine circles, which again would be fitting if she died and was resurrected. Or again, if we just go off the symbolism we're given, perhaps it just means that she is connected to the cycle, or that her sense of justice is surrounded by obsession. Now that we know the first book of Marvpius and know where the twins came from and that seemed to be their mother's doing, a mother, which by the way, is represented by an upside down triangle with a line through it, or in other words, Earth. Earth in occultism often represents a motherly figure or nurturing, since everything comes from Earth. This, therefore, is a fitting symbol for their mother. And since their mother seemed to lead to everything that's happened to them, it makes sense that on their family banner for the two of them, we see the Earth symbol at the top next to the name. The two forever exist in the shadow of their mother's actions. But now that we know that first book, let's look at some of the stuff we hear in the second book. In the first stanza, we hear about the wrathful times once again. When the serpent's tongue hissed and, as was described by young Ashley Carter, bad things happened in the town and all was consumed in a great fire. Something we don't know about yet, but we'll probably get clarification on with future entries. But it refers to Marvpius as the drowned artist. Perhaps he's called that because of his flute playing, but it says that he rose from the pungent waters, or as we know now, the drowned city. So at some point after Madhouse became Marvpius, he came to the lake and went down to the drowned city. Then all was seemingly destroyed by the viper, but once the viper left, then Marvpius arose. Perhaps the viper's presence is the thing we saw in the VHS tales. Giant circles appearing in the sky, a physical manifestation of a cycle, and one that draws people in it and allows them to be converted by it. I mean, Ethan said all the way back then that it's a representation of forever. It has no beginning, it has no end, yet it is. And the thing like the Wendigo stalking the woods. I mean, the people in the Starving Five said these kinds of things just happen in town. If you're not careful, you disappear. Perhaps all of that was the viper's wrath. And then there was a great fire, the viper went away, and Marvpius arose. Marvpius is also explicitly described as being under the viper, as it says in the third stanza that he's servant to a certain viper's sin. This also connects to what the serpent speaks through Madhouse to Martha at the end of part three, where the viper effectively says that he rose up Marvpius, that he created him for this purpose. The fourth stanza that says, "A trade, a price was paid, his kin spared from the gloom of the lake, and now his flesh in torment laid." Again, now that's very plainly understood as what Madhouse did for his sister. However, in the seventh stanza, when it's describing Marvpius entering the town, it says, "The city of snow, where once two miracles were born from divine glow." Again, in my opinion, this probably refers to the twins. It seems confusing that this city seems to be Old Oakburn, and from what we saw at the beginning, if they were born in the 1800s, it seems they started around Germany. But assuming this is Old Oakburn that's being discussed, perhaps the twins weren't supposed to exist in the first place. Perhaps their mother made some kind of deal to allow them to be hers. Perhaps some kind of blasphemous immaculate conception. So they were two miracles who then the mother lost, and she pledged her allegiance to have them back. Which is the same thing Madhouse would do for Martha years later. So most of the details we have about the story are pretty clear. We can kind of guess where they're going with things like the Ludolph mother. But we know other stuff for sure. Martha and Madhouse are brother and sister. We understand how the sigils work, who they represent, how Marvpius brings new people in on his schemes, with how we see Carter become seduced. We know all of that, but there's still a lot of stuff we don't know. Like, for example, why were the Lebedevs murdered? I mean, they're obviously connected to something. Their great or great-great-grandfather, or that was the 1850s, so add some more greats. That Lebedev personally knew the Ludolph mother and wrote of the first book of Marvpius. So then, over 150 years later, by coincidence, another two Lebedevs are killed on the behalf of Marvpius. And the details around them are a little too specific. This murder seems too important.
They were photographers. They were murdered in the dark room of their home. Maybe they saw something while they were taking photographs that they shouldn't have seen. So once Marpius had the capability, he sent his servant to kill them. We also have what's probably the biggest question of the whole series, and something that will probably be answered near the end. What is the serpent? I mean, there's obvious, you know, religious, satanic ties to serpent imagery. The animal most often equated to the devil of the Bible is that of a serpent. In his first appearance to Adam and Eve, he presented himself as a serpent, and in that instance as well, enticed man to fall into his will and out of their favor, simply dressed in the visage of what they think they want. Much like how I'm sure the serpent of this story made a deal with Madhouse and likely his mother. Whatever it is, it's something powerful, and it seems to be at the heart of this story. As far as my opinion goes, I think it could be the devil. I think this could all be demonic influence. I equally think it could be a, once again, Lovecraftian horror, that this is just some community, some element outside of our nature that we're not equipped to deal with. There's no telling, but whatever it is, I think it's going to be something cool. Also, at the very end of part three, when it seems the serpent is speaking through Madhouse, he says, "And my dead throat shall cast upon this earth the fire of the nine circles," which once again sounds like a reference to hell, "to the land that plunged me into darkest pits, to blazing marble, to the drowned city so below, and those who skin the lungs of mine will scream into the void." So this sounds like the serpent at one point was cast out and cast down. He was plunged into the darkest pits. His lungs were skinned. That certainly sounds like a reference to the Marcius myth. And he says these people that did him wrong will scream into the void. They will scream the name of that beast, Marvpius. So it seems Marvpius has been made as a tool for vengeance. And it's hard to tell if Madhouse has accepted his role or is simply a vessel for what the serpent wants. There's a ton of questions the series still has in store, but by the way it's answered everything thus far and how well each piece has been set up, I'm sure there's an answer waiting for us. Remember that series trailer I mentioned a moment ago that has a reference to Marcius in its opening? Well, most of the trailer is shots from the series set to the song, The Boy with the Gun. Again, a song that I think is fitting to describe Madhouse, the situation he has found himself in. Or perhaps if the serpent is on a mission of retribution, the situation the Viper has found himself in. But if you go to the end of that trailer, we see Oakburn Opus Part 1, 2, 3, and Lies. And again, this trailer was released right before Lies came out. But then we see Oakburn Opus Part 4 and Oakburn Opus 5, the finale. Like I said, Red Diamond has had this planned from the start. There are set to be two more mainline entries in the series, and I think it will answer all of our questions, give us some more, but whatever happens, it'll be cool. Like I said, I haven't seen a series that has captured me this much in a while. There are so many cool theories to draw on. There's so many symbols we get and things to play with. I'm sure someone that's more familiar with occultism than me can probably make more inferences based on the symbols we see and things like the family banner. I'm sure there's a ton of cool Easter eggs in that. There's so much knowledge here that pieces itself together to create a satisfying narrative where we can clearly see there is an architect behind the scenes of it all, but he doesn't show his hand. The story never gets too excited and reveals its hand too early so that we know that it knows what it's doing. Instead, Red Diamond takes his time, paces it out, and because of it, the whole thing feels satisfying. Even if we don't have all our answers yet, the adventure to get there has been well worth our time. So once again, I cannot hype this series up enough. Go check it out in the description, subscribe to the Red Diamond channel, and also sign up to the Patreon if you can. Like I said, good artists need good support. This is an amazing horror project that I want to see more of, and hopefully you do too, and hopefully you enjoyed this video, and I just want to say thank you for watching. I had seen the Nexpo video on this, and it was, I think, when just part two was out, and I went and found the channel and saw there were more entries and was absolutely blown away by part three and Lies. I love this. I can't wait for more to come out. Red Diamond also announced on their Patreon that there would be another series, I believe called Nowhere Boulevard, that I don't think is going to have a connection to Oakburn Opus, but if this guy's making horror projects, I'm there for it. Also, if you want to know something even more depressing, if you look at his channel description, it says that he's 19 years old. First it was Alex, then it was Kane. There's all these children who are better at this than I will ever be. And that's great for them. I'm happy for them, but also, ow. But for real, support Red Diamond at the links in the description if you can. He certainly deserves it. Thank you guys for sticking around. Sorry for a lack of content at the beginning of the year. It's been a hectic time, as you can imagine. More videos will be on the way very soon, including some that you guys probably think I've forgotten about and have been requesting for a while. Thank you all so much for your support. Thank you for sticking it out with me into 2026. I can't wait to see what the year has in store for us. But I believe that should do it for now. Before I go, I just want to say thank you for watching.
I hope that you enjoyed, and I'll see you in the next one. Bye! Also, I promise I do not just try to find scary things that relate to Christian imagery, right? I just look for scary things, and then all of the cool ones have that. And I didn't do it, and I didn't tell them to do it. That's just how the world works. Don't know what that says about the world or me or anything, but I'm not sorry.